Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Action Radio. This is Greg Penglis coming to you from the historic district of downtown Milton on the banks of the beautiful Blackwater River. And now let's get into Action Radio. Well, welcome to another Monday. Let's see what we can do today to upset everybody and you know, reach all kinds of new conclusions, new insights, new who knows what's going on. A bunch of stuff in the news just before I got on the show and sort of watching what's happening and a couple of things over the weekend. So a little bit of announcements here. First of all, an Action Radio announcement. Our Canadian listeners are increasing, which is great. And so, of course, most of our listeners are still in the United States. But just the idea that we have other people, you know, around the world listening, and they're listening in greater numbers. Whoop, maybe one thing here. There we go. Had to reach back for a second. But the fact that we have more and more people listening in North America, especially, I mean, Mexico, Canada, we're getting some great listeners in Central America. South America seems to be sort of declining a little bit. Maybe we're just a little bit beyond reach. And really hoping to get some listeners in Ukraine, which would be fabulous. Listeners in the Muslim countries, you know, places I wouldn't expect, Turkey, Iran, Afghanistan. And, of course, it could be American service people. It very likely is. But just the fact that they're listening there, they haven't blocked us out. China listens. Russia listens. And so Thailand is back on the board. And so Vietnam has always been there for some reason. It's fascinating the places that that have consistent listeners. Slovenia has always been a listener. Switzerland, you know, so the various places have never left us. Kenya's come and gone. They're back. Other places have come and gone. You know, it's just Africa's not a big listenership for Action Radio yet, but we're working on it, especially when we start doing international law and things like, child labor laws and worker protection of people that have to mine the minerals and chemicals for all those wonderful electric cars that they're pushing on us. And so anyway, let me, I got a story to tell you. And I have about an hour in the first hour. We're going to sort of chat a little bit. And anybody's welcome to call me, 215-383-3832. And, of course, as soon as I say that, I realize that I didn't do the live chat. So I have to type in what's on your mind for a live chat. It's at the bottom of your broadcast page. So that's where you'll find that. And that will allow you to type in literally anywhere in the world also. And so we do have the worldwide reach, I think, is really important, especially as we get our Australian Bill of Rights, which should be coming out. The presentation should be coming out this week. What's on your mind? There we go. So we get that all set. That's ready to go. Skype line is open too. Generally, if you want to call the show, you have to call the day before so that you have a chance to see it and then okay the conversation that you can call in. Then you can call in directly. That's how it works. And so once you're established as an account there, then that's okay. I had someone from Russia wanted to sell some product, some, you know, anti-hacking computer thing. It was probably a hacking computer thing, which is why I turned them down. So, yeah, just because you apply doesn't mean you're going to get in. All right. So this is how God, you know, drops ideas into my head. Saturday morning, right? So this is the only day of the week I get to sleep in. I don't have a wake-up time. Every other day of the week, I mean, you know, I do a day job Sunday, and of course I have the show Monday to Friday. So Saturdays are kind of cool. And so I'm struggling awake, and I'm making my tea, and I tend to drop my tea bags, you know, into the tea, spilling all kinds of tea all over my counter, and I'm you know, cursing in various ways. And there's an ad playing on the TV at the same time, and it talked about some like home office home thing. And of course, inspiration hits. I'm like, home? Office, huh? You know, home office. What if homes are going to be built with offices one day? I'm like, oh, well, that's interesting. You know, I'm thinking to myself, is this whole, apparently it's called I sort of threw in the term hybrid, but apparently that's a real term that's actually being used and has been used for a while, that this whole idea of the home office or working from home, it was forced with COVID. But now the big question is how long is it going to stay? And what are the ramifications of a home office home situation? And so I got a bunch of notes that kind of randomly scattered. I'll save my opening comments. I'd rather get into the story here. I think it's more interesting. And since I tend to ramble, I can always cover some of the other points later. But I'm thinking, you know, to myself, you know, are homes going to be built, you know, with an office space automatically? Are they going to have like a room in them? This is different than our usual topics, okay? But it isn't. It will get to politics, trust me. Everything does. But I'm just thinking, you know, because people are now taking rooms in their house and they're having to create offices because they're at home. And I'm thinking, okay, well, a couple of things immediately come to mind. One, the traffic should be less on the roads, you know, with fewer cars. You know, the traffic planners, engineers, they have an automatic solution. Of course, with less fuel being burned, there's you know, the government's getting, they're not getting the same amount of gas and sales taxes, which should be interesting. That was the dichotomy in California, that they begged people, coerced people, and finally threatened people to get into electric cars and get rid of their older cars with carburetors and things like that. And so we would conserve fuel. Well, we did conserve fuel, and then they lost tax money, and so they raised the taxes. It was a fascinating thing. Anyway, so what's going to happen to our world? Where are we going with this? What is this whole idea of the home office thing? Is it going to be a requirement? Is it going to be a desired thing? Are certain companies going to have more home, you know, workers and things like that, you know, as opposed to office workers? And a few things actually came to mind just before. I got some notes from Saturday, Sunday, and today. The ones today are some of the more fun ones. What if you don't want to work at home? What if you can't stand your, you know, spouse, partner, kids, parents, you know, live in son in the basement who's 35? You know, what if you really like getting out of the house and going to work? I mean, is this going to cause more, just as COVID caused more problems, domestic problems? Is this new home environment, if it's required or continued, you know, are people going to, you know, like, are they going to go, oh, no, I really like going to the office. I get away from all these people. And the folks that are working at home saying, I really don't want to go to the office. I don't want to see those people. So it works the other way, too. So a certain percentage of people are going to want to stay home because they hate the office, and a certain amount of people are going to want to go to the office because they hate their home. I don't know what to do with that. But it's interesting, all the folks that are the climate change folks and all the other people, they're not saying, hey, look, we're reducing our CO2 emissions by more people working at home. Isn't this great? They're not doing that because they want to eliminate two things, the automobile. The personal choice automobile, they call it single driver. I don't like that term, single driver. It implies that you should share your seats with other people. And that's the intent, right? Because you should share everything. That's the whole purpose of a society devoid of individual rights, is everybody shares everything. And we call that communism, right? And so, the environmentalists aren't screaming and yelling at look at this, isn't this great? We've reduced emissions so much because people are working from home. You know, and so the fact they're not doing that tells me that they don't want any cars on the road. I mean, that's ultimately where they're going. Look at the Brandon insurrection and the leftists that want to, you know, ban all drilling of oil. Well, okay. Well, that means they're going to have no, you know, natural abiotic oil, no earth-made oil. You know, you're going to just eliminate that as an energy source. You know, we're all going to go to electricity. Well, isn't that wonderful? Electricity is clean. Okay. Well, solar and wind can only produce so much of it. And usually they do it by killing birds and frying things and doing all kinds of nasty stuff. Solar panels on a house are great. Solar panels in the middle of a huge field that used to be a forest are disgusting. You know, those wind generators, if every rooftop had a small windmill with like a foot span, foot and a half, maybe 2 feet blades at the most, you know, that's one thing. But these massive blades that are going over 200 miles an hour at the tip, you know, they're just killing birds of prey, especially eagles. You know, you like American eagles? Okay, then stop the windmills. You know, and plus the waste. I was reading about another thing today, high-tech waste. All of those solar panels, apparently their efficiency degrades 1% a year. Well, that's a lot. You know, I mean, the efficiency of gasoline doesn't degrade at all. As far as I know, I mean, you don't store it that long, but the thing is you can. I think you can store it, and you have some, like, you know, anti-moisture components and things like that. Gasoline actually stores. That's why we have a strategic petroleum reserve. That's stored petroleum, okay? Well, you can't really store electricity unless you put it somewhere. So the electricity that's generated in those power plants has to be used. Where's it going to go? It's got to go somewhere. It's going to go into the environment. It's going to go, you know, leak out the power lines. It's going to go somewhere. You know, it's going to go into your car, then it has to go into a battery. You know, if it's going to go in your Duracells, you know, to power the mouse on your computer. I say that because my mouse goes through a lot of Duracell batteries. But the cable one is far worse. It doesn't work as well. So I use the mouse one. I use the battery one. But it's all fascinating how this works. And there's tremendous waste in all this new technology, electric technology. But the thing is that the thing that sort of shocked me today, and I'll get back to houses. Don't worry. I mean, we've got an hour. This is kind of a long story. But what shocked me is that the amount of waste. The incredible, but the thing is, it takes energy to create electricity. Electricity, I got this article I was reading a little bit this morning too. Sort of crammed my head full of stuff, though. That's why I can just talk. And I was talking about energy. Electricity is a secondary source because it takes energy to create electricity. So electricity is not a primary source. You can't find it, mine it. You know, you can't dig it up. You can't, you can't collect it. you've got to produce it. Well, how do you produce it? Well, with primary energy sources, you know, coal, natural gas and nuclear are the primary sources. I guess they're getting rid of the oil burning electric plants, but coal, nuclear, and natural gas power most of our electric plants. So the very thing they're trying to get rid of is powering the one energy source that they want to keep. Now, I don't think they've realized there's a contradiction there. And I was trying to find some articles on the danger of a single energy source. In other words, if electricity is our only source of power, you know, then that what it means is that all the petroleum products, you know, all the natural gas and coal, coal's petroleum based, you know, it's the same stuff, right? And nuclear, the only places those places will be used is in electric power plants. Well, isn't that interesting? What if they outlaw the use of any kind of petroleum product except, I guess they're going to keep plastics and fertilizer and things like that. But if they get rid of automobile fuel, in other words, they get rid of gasoline and they get rid of diesel, and the only source of power is electric, that means the only people who can use, you know, gasoline, diesel, petroleum products, or like I say, coal, oil, natural gas, and nuclear are power plants. That makes them the primary source. Well, I found that interesting. Anyway, so with the home offices, a lot more people be working from home. Well, that means the office doesn't have an electric bill. The office doesn't have as much commercial rental space. So that market's declining. The people that sell gasoline won't sell as much because people aren't driving. The tolls for those bridges, those tolls are going to drop. I don't think people have really thought this through. You know, the they want to, and it raises the question, you know, is this by design or is this an accident of COVID or was this going to happen anyway? And the honest answer is I have no clue because there are no sources on this right now. We're kind of breaking some new ground here. And anytime I break new ground with a show, it gets very experimental and I never really know exactly how it's going to go. So this is why we're going to kind of delve into this. But one of the biggest articles I found, and the reason I got suspicious, was from the World Economic Forum, the WEF. You know, Klaus Schwab and the Great Reset, yeah, you will give up your private property and you'll be happy. I'm thinking to myself, well, what is the World Economic Forum? What is the interest in this home office move? This move, and there's another thing I heard about too, deurbanization. I caught a quick thing which I'll probably check after the show too. This is going to be an ongoing project. This is not going to be done today. But the idea of deurbanizing, in other words, moving people out of the cities, not into the suburbs because they don't want suburbs, you know, basically rural. So they want to urbanize the rural environment. I don't know what they're going to do with the suburbs. They want to sort of, you know, move people out of the city into their home offices. And I guess the only people left in cities will be dependent Democrats, illegal aliens, and a peasant class. So I don't know what these folks have in mind. Like I say, is it intentional? Or is it an accident? Or is it accidental? I don't know. I usually lean to purposeful and intentional whenever I look at these things, especially when the World Economic Forum is documenting so carefully this whole home office move. But you know, and if you look at an individual level and a nationwide level and a worldwide level, well, let's take the individual. So you're a young couple. You know, are you going to buy a house? And you can custom design your house, right? A friend of mine had a house built for her and it was involved in the whole process, designed exactly the way she wanted, had all the different modular things and stuff. It's great. It's wonderful. I might do that myself. I'm going to have a log cabin outside, you know, with sky domes and a completely modern interior, basically one big room. It's going to be fascinating, you know, and that'll be part recording studio, part radio studio, part, you know, big screen TV taking up an entire wall and who knows, and big kitchen so I can, you know, make cool stuff. And of course, a 5-car garage for my toys. So that's going to be my come home one day. So a lot more listeners from now. Anyway, but involved in these custom homes is an option going to be to build in a home office. You know, usually when you build things in as opposed to renovate, you're a lot better off. And so will there be discounts? Will there be, you know, and if you say, okay, I want this home built, well, you can have choice A or choice B. Choice A, you know, is a standard home with, you know, living room, kitchen, bathrooms, bedrooms, you know, man cave, woman cave, you know, whatever you want, a garage, you know, things. Okay, that's true. That's home A. Home B would include a home office. So in other words, they take a living room or they take a couple of other rooms, they'd move a wall around and you'd have extra electric outlets. You'd have places for, you know, communications. You'd have like the Wi-Fi would be centered there, you know, whatever it takes to create an office. And of course, being a defined office space, it'd probably make it easier for the office deduction on your taxes because, well, I mean, it's actually called the office. It's in the you know, the real estate. It's in the home description. This is the office, okay? And so, again, I don't know. This is going to be an interesting trend to see if homes come that way. and whether this is going to be the trend where people actually select a home with a built-in office space, whether or not they use it. Here's another thing, too. And this is something that was I found one of the articles, too, but I was thinking of this as well. When you work from home, there's no time clock. Okay, you're always on the clock. You know, when you go to work, you know, then when you leave work, you go home. Okay, there's a split. But if you work at home, there's no split. You're stuck. And what if the boss says, well, you're at home. Why don't you just do it this evening? You know, well, I was planning to, you know, it's Tuesday night. I was going bowling. Well, yeah, but this is more important. What's more important, your job or your bowling? You know, but you see, before when you worked at the office and you left at 5 o'clock, you know, this mythical 9 to 5 that existed, I think that ended in the 70s sometime when it went to from 9 to 5 to 8 to 5. And then it went to 8 to 5:30 because they didn't pay for your lunch anymore. It just keeps going. You know, it never stops. It's probably 8 to 6. And then, of course, you're for own salary. It's 8 until you're done. You know, and then it's 7 until you're done. And the office keeps changing. But there was a time when we worked 9 to 5. You went to the office. You started work at 9 approximately. And you had your coffee break at like 10:15 to 10:30. And then they had lunch from 12 to 1. That's included, by the way, in 9 to 5. 9 to 5 is 8 hours. We've already, you know, then you have your afternoon coffee break. So you've lost an hour and a half in the middle of the day. So your 8.5, so your 8-hour day is actually 6.5 hours, not counting the time that you're goofing around when you should be working. So we had it really easy. We had it cushy back in the 60s, 70s, even through the 80s, because, let's say 60s and 70s, because we were it. I mean, we had the world market. We had all the factories, all the production. You know, made in Japan was a joke until the Japanese cars came in. It was like, oh. That's not so funny anymore. People aren't buying, you know, 1972 T-Birds that are gas-guzzling, huge, monstrous, total waste of metal, don't work, don't care, you know, and they figured the Americans would buy them because there was no other choice. As soon as there was other choice, Honda, Toyota, yeah, baby, and the Volkswagen, the bug, you know, all these different things came in, and it's like, huh, well, this is different, you know, so things changed. So my question is, are things changing with the home, too? And is the option to work at home going to become the duty to work at home? And if you're not on a time clock, how much time do you have? You know, you can work weekends. And are people going to naturally work more because they don't have a time clock? And, well, I'll just get this done. Sorry, hon. You know, I'll join the family, you know, for Easter later. I just have a little thing to do. And a little thing turns into an entire day of work. Then you missed your family. Oh, boy. So there's a lot of ramifications. There's a lot of things to think about as far as this. Let me consult my notes here. Then I got some articles for you. If you want to talk about this, I think it's fascinating. But again, the reason I think that the World Economic Forum is documenting this so carefully is because they're in on it. And they want to move to an all-electric society. And the reason for that is so they can control how much electricity you get. Because all the smart meters in your home, yeah, they can also meter how much electricity. And I'm going to look more into that too. But they're going to have a smart grid. So the smart meter doesn't meter your electricity, the grid will. So they want to move to a place where the government controls your energy use. You know, they use the guise of climate change and all this other stuff, but what it really comes down to is managing your energy. And part of my theory, and part of the reason I think this is completely intentional, to get people into homes, to force us into an electric-only energy source, and to, you know, get rid of what they call the single passenger car, what I'll just call it, you know, passenger cars, you know, where one person can drive where they want, which is kind of the idea of having a car, right? And single-family homes. Getting you into these urban infill, massive apartment complex, things like that. It started in the 90s with what they called smart growth. And if you look up smart growth and climate change, you'll see that the solutions to climate change are smart growth. Well, what is smart growth? Getting rid of single family homes and passenger cars. That's what it is. Why? Well, because they cause the most pollution. You know, they put carbon dioxide into the air. All right. So underpinning all of this entire wacko, bizarre philosophy is the idea that carbon dioxide is bad. See, all the things they're doing, and we'll get into net zero, that's the real villain. That's where they're going with this, net zero. In other words, a society that produces no carbon dioxide, which is irrational, because carbon dioxide helps the plants. You know, you're cutting off your food supply. The more you reduce carbon dioxide, the more you're cutting the food supply available to human beings on the planet. That in itself is a crime, okay? I mean, but we'll get into that later. But as things are channeled, as things are reduced, as our options are going, as we're put into this this very controlled environment, it started with smart growth. And again, this is in the 90s. I remember documenting this. I wrote articles on it back in the 90s. And look at this stuff. And I'm thinking, get rid of the passenger car, get rid of the single family home. We're all going to live together in one beautiful community. We'll work where we live. Oh, wait a minute. Isn't that what the home office hybrid is, working where you live? You know, so in other words, what they recommended and tried to demand back in the 90s through COVID, they've actually brought about. Now they want to keep it. So I don't know if this is intentional or accidental. In other words, was it intentional to lock people down and force them into their homes in COVID? And then all of a sudden, since they're in their homes and people are more used to working in their homes, well, let's just keep that going. It's like the fourth booster. Well, you've taken three already. What's one more? Keep going. Let's do it every year. Let's do it twice a year. Let's do it four times a year. Your quarterly booster. I mean, you know, if they can sell the product, they will. So what's the product here? That's my question. What's the product? What's the product of having more and more people live at home, work at home, stay at home, don't commute, don't get out? You know, is this going to produce cabin fever? You know, if you go to Alaska, they have something called cabin fever. And that's mostly because of darkness. So in the wintertime, it's freezing cold and it's dark for like 2 months. The sun barely, you know, there's almost no daylight. Well, people go crazy. They need sunshine. They need contact with other people. And if they stay in their cabins, they get cabin fever. They go insane, you know, eventually. Well, are we inducing mass cabin fever by having everybody live and work at home? Like I say, I mean, most marriages are dependent on one person leaving and going somewhere else to work. I'm convinced of that. You know, it's crazy as it sounds, and, you know. I think that's kind of how it goes. So all these things are playing in. And again, I don't have answers. This is a question show. This is a show where we start, you know, putting things out there and see what happens. You know, like if there are fewer, let me just kind of go through my notes here. I've got, is the World Economic Forum, the folks that brought us the plan for COVID with Event 201, documenting this phenomenon or directing it? So are they documenting or directing? So Event 201, that was the thing that happened in October of 2019, which was basically the dry run, was the practice run for COVID, where they limited the media, where they had forced vaccination as the only thing, where they got rid of all the early treatments. They rehearsed the whole thing in Event 201. You can look it up. Right? I'm not making this stuff up. And it was run by the World Economic Forum, the same people that want to have you give up your private property, give up your rights, give up everything, submit yourself to the greater world government and the greater good and all this other stuff. It's all the things we're fighting with our Australian Bill of Individual Rights, which should be out this week. And as soon as it is, I'm going to be doing shows on that because that is a fascinating thing. That is the objection to this. So the question is the option to live and work at home going to become the mandate to live and work at home? Is the option to not necessarily buy cars going to be the mandate to not own cars? Or is it going to be the mandate to own electric cars and be an all-electric economy that's regulated by government because the government owns all the utilities? Okay, this is the problem with a single energy source. All right, so that's one note I had. I had another note here. Will all jobs become part-time and all home workers able to work, contracts, temporary jobs, or multiple companies at the same time? If you're in an office, you are working for that company. If you're at home, who knows how many companies you're working for? So is that going to be a situation where we're going to have multiple contracts, multiple short-term things, multiple jobs working for multiple companies? And how are you going to juggle that? Well, I can't work for you now. I have to do something else. Well, I thought you worked for us. Oh, well, I do work for you, but I also work for, you know, four other companies. Oh, really? Well, you're going to have to make a decision. Is it us or them? Okay, them. You know, I mean, people, these are some things you think about. You know, if companies know that, are they going to pay you less because they can get more work out of you knowing that you're working for, that everybody's working for multiple companies? I mean, I don't know. I'm just asking the questions. Action Radio is a hybrid company. You know, I'm broadcasting from where I live, which is kind of cool. All right, here we go. Little computer, off we go. I've said this before. It's no big secret. You know, plug in the microphone into the computer and off we go. A lot of folks do that. Most of the big major stars, you know, they have like their home studios and things like that. It's very cool. So this is hybrid. We're definitely hybrid because most people, well, I don't know. I say half the people, well, I'm not really sure. I think a lot of folks call in from home, but a lot of folks call in from work too, depending on what their jobs are. So we're kind of a hybrid company in that the people that work with Action Radio are all over the country, you know, and sometimes, you know, different parts of the world. You know, Australia, we have Jen Clark working on the Bill of Rights, Alan Dawson in Belize. I got my friend Anthony Williams, who's going to join us again from New Zealand. And so we have different folks. We had a reporter from Canada, another Jen Clark, Jennifer Clark, up there, up in Ottawa, who gave an incredible show for an hour. It was amazing how all this works. But that's, so we are definitely a worldwide company, which is quite interesting. But we're definitely hybrid, you know, but who knows? Who knows where the future of this is going to go? But it's fascinating. This is just one example. So part of what makes all this possible are the new technologies. You got new technologies for meetings, you know, you got Zoom, you got everything else, but some people say that's impersonal. But that's going to cut down on business travel. So there's another industry that's going to be affected. You know, business travel used to be a huge part of the airline's money. So the airlines are going to have problems. Well, that's okay. They got pilot shortages anyway, so they got all kinds of things. And anyway, what I want to do, I've pretty much spelled it out that this is definitely, I think I've covered it. This is definitely a more of a question than an answer. So let me get to some of the articles that I have here, and I'll play a couple of things. Oh, it's probably a good time to play my Santa Rosa. I got caught up in this project, you know, but I'm going to do Santa Rosa Volunteers, Federalist number 11 in a little bit. So let me play something here. Play one of my other ones. This may be a bit shorter so we can get back to this. Let's do the Sedition Act. I haven't played that one for a while. This one is very interesting because you look at what's going on with the whole January 6th thing. And these people are talking about, you know, the insurrection and, you know, the plot to overthrow the government, which of course they did. You know, that's the funny part about it. But it's all sedition. You know, you're speaking against your government, which of course in a free society is perfectly legal, but in a controlled society is not. So play this for you. We have a special interviewing up for you in the second hour. And this is another one with Dr. Roger Roots. He was on a few weeks ago. We talked about how the Western states, all that and they get over and open it up for oil and gas and make their own state parks and do whatever they want with it anytime they want. But they don't. And I'm not sure why they don't. But anyway, I did an interview almost 5 years ago with Dr. Roger Roots on fully informed juries and FIJA, the Fully Informed Jury Association. And a lot of things we talked about there are just as current today. And so I'm going to talk to him. In fact, I'm going to send him our judicial bills, the ones that getting rid of judicial review or at least severely limiting it, having Supreme Court juries, there's a concept for you. In other words, a jury of the people review the decisions of the Supreme Court. That may become really necessary. I want to write a bill on congressional oversight of the Supreme Court. You know, I mean, Congress oversees all the executive branches. Why shouldn't they oversee the Supreme Court? Why wouldn't it be independent? Okay, well, they will be independent. You know, but they still have to conform to the Constitution and good behavior. And good behavior is determined by the Congress. So in that respect, there's oversight. You know, the Supreme Court can exercise oversight by issuing opinions saying that certain policies or actions of the Congress or the president or the executive are unconstitutional. And then the other branch will gang up on that one branch that's, you know, abrogating and doing the wrong thing. And that's how it works. So the way it's supposed to work, Supreme Court's not supposed to rule and make policy and fix things. Supreme Court's supposed to issue opinions. If they say that something the president is doing illegal, they issue that opinion. Congress says, okay, great, we're going to change the law so the president can't do that. In the same way, if Supreme Court says Congress passed a law that, in our opinion, is unconstitutional, the president says, great, we're going to delete that, we're going to defund it, we're going to do something. I'm not going to, you know, do your next, you know, budget, whatever, until you fix this. So that's how it's supposed to work. You know, it's not supposed to be the Supreme Court says, okay, here's the problem, we're going to rule it illegal, we're going to make a ruling, we're going to issue orders, and we're going to issue policies, and everybody has to follow us. That's a judicial dictatorship. And so it all started very quickly with Marbury versus Madison, as we know, and the whole idea of judicial review of the judiciary taking over. But a lot of it really started before that with the Sedition Acts. In other words, the government said that you couldn't do what the Constitution said you could do. And this is what this is. I'll play this for you. Be right back after this presentation. Oh, my computer's moving. There we go. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with Founding Moments, insights into our founding documents, sponsored by Santa Rosa Volunteers here in Santa Rosa County, Florida. Santa Rosa Volunteers is available at their website, srv1776.com. That's srv1776.com. This week, I want to break from the Federalist and Anti-Federalist papers to consider one of the many aberrations in the early days of the land of the free. That is the Sedition Act of 1798. Granted, this is always grouped with the companion bills on aliens, but I see them as separate issues. Why would a new government formed from colonies under rules of sedition from a foreign monarch bring about that same tyranny into our government so early in its existence? The Constitution was ratified on September 17, 1787. The Bill of Rights was ratified on December 15, 1791. So it was already in the supreme law of the land that Congress could make no law that abridged the freedom of speech, thus making any subordinate law on sedition unconstitutional automatically. And yet, it happened. All power corrupts, Absolute power corrupts, absolutely. Therefore, if you have a government of good laws and yet bad officials who crave the preservation of power more than the alleged guarantees of freedom, freedom takes second place. You can see that in evidence throughout the entire government response to a coronavirus that would have run its course naturally in about 10 weeks, just like the flu every year, and would have been gone by the summer of 2020 when all viruses fade until the winter. And yet, look at the massive amount of power taken from the people in a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. Sedition is defined in my online dictionary as conduct or speech inciting people to rebel against the authority of a state or monarch. So what did the government put into a law that so obviously came from the former ruler of the colonies into the new government of the United States? The Sedition Act is titled An Act for the Punishment of Certain Crimes Against the United States. In other words, conduct or speech that criticizes the government. Where have we heard that before? Section 1 of the Sedition Act reads, "Be it enacted by the Senate and House of Representatives of the United States of America, in Congress assembled, that if any persons shall unlawfully combine or conspire together with intent to oppose any measure or measures of the government of the United States, which are or shall be directed by proper authority, or to impede the operation of any law of the United States, or to intimidate or prevent any person holding a place or office in or under the government of the United States from undertaking, performing, or executing his trust or duty, and if any person or persons with intent as aforesaid shall counsel, advise, or attempt to procure any insurrection, riot, unlawful assembly, or combination, whether such conspiracy, threatening, counsel, advice, or attempt shall have the proposed effect or not, he or they shall be deemed guilty of a high misdemeanor." This, of course, violates the entire First Amendment, except with regard to religion. It gets worse. Section 2 says in part, "And be it further enacted, that if any person shall write, print, utter, or publish, or shall cause or procure to be written, printed, uttered, or published, or shall knowingly and willingly assist or aid in writing, printing, uttering, or publishing any false, scandalous, and malicious writing or writings against the government of the United States, or either House of the Congress of the United States, or of the President of the United States, with intent to defame the said government, or either House of the said Congress, or the said President, or to bring them, or either of them, into contempt or disrepute, or to excite against them, or either or any of them, the hatred of the good people of the United States." In other words, saying anything against the government of the United States or anyone in it is a crime punishable by jail and fines. This effectively creates political prisoners in the United States, much like the innocent people in the D.C. Gulag jail for being in the Capitol building January 6th. If that were not bad enough, within the Sedition Act is probably the most dangerous provision to individual liberty that I have yet seen in the founding documents, and provides a shocking precursor to the future neutralization of our jury system and the supremacy of the government courts over the people. Section 3. "And be it further enacted and declared that if any person shall be prosecuted under this act for the writing or publishing any libel aforesaid, it shall be lawful for the defendant upon the trial of the cause to give an evidence in his defense, the truth of the matter contained in publication charged as a libel, and the jury who shall try the cause shall have a right to determine the law and the facts under the direction of the court, as in other cases." The key words here are "under the direction of the court." The whole point of a jury is to not only determine the guilt of the defendant, the restitution in a civil case, but most important for the jury is to determine whether the laws implied are fair, just, constitutional, and are not arbitrary and capricious reservoirs of unlimited government power over the people. Jurors can do whatever they want because they are the representatives of the people over the judges who work for the government and therefore work for the people. And yet, as virtually every judge instructs their juries, that they can only judge the facts of the case and not the law. That lie is repeated every day in courts all across the country. And now I see where it came from. Section 3 is really saying that the juries, and therefore the people, are under the direction of the court. What the Sedition Act really does is makes criticism of the government a crime and allows government judges to direct the juries that would hear any case under this act, thus destroying the right of free speech and to redress grievances against the government and to due process and the right to a jury trial of one's peers. One could imagine anyone charged under this act would be guilty until proven innocent, and then ruined by government if they were proved innocent. Can you think of any parallels to the rights of free speech today? The Sedition Act was approved July 14, 1798, signed by John Adams, President of the United States. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with Founding Moments, sponsored by Santa Rosa Volunteers. Their website is srv1776.com. That's srv1776.com. Please share this report to anyone who needs it. All right, let's get back here. I've got, I have so many articles here, and I got all this stuff swimming in my head. Again, on the local front, we're talking about your home and how to redesign your home. And in fact, there's an entire industry sprouting up now about office renovation, home stuff, furniture, office supplies, you know, all kinds of things to turn your home into an office. It's always been there, but with the amount of people working from home, it's kind of exploded. So let me kind of start there and get on to some of the other things I find. This is probably an ad. This one website looks like an ad. I guess it's called HON. So I'm guessing that's Home Office Network. That would be my guess. And they've got all kinds of other stuff here. But they're talking about build your space. And the way they talk about it, I'll just give you a little bit of what they say. They say, let's see if I can, there's an article written by somebody. No, it's just an ad from this website, HON. It says, what's happened in your work lately? Perhaps you start a new job that allows remote flexibility. So watch the language changes here. This is going to get fascinating. Or maybe you're among the Americans who found out they aren't returning to the office anytime soon or ever. Yeah, there's the fourth part. It says, if you're in either category, you should be thinking about the long-term plan for your home workspace. So in other words, the homes and work, they're going to merge. I don't know if people think about that. Are you going to be buying a home? You know, as a real estate person say, you know, what would you like for the office in your home? You know, huh? Yeah, well, we have certain homes that, you know, we're offering home office combos. We're offering, would you like to buy a hybrid? You know, what's that? Well, that's a home with an office space already built in. You know, I mean, the world is changing, and it's changing fast. And again, this is by design to get people out of cars and out of single-family homes and turn homes into offices. Does this come from the smart growth, which was a whole idea to combine work and living into the same space and public transit and entertainment all in one little area in a government plan community, which people rejected back in the 90s. So then they introduced climate change, right? I was going to get to this earlier, but I should probably mention it now. So they talk about climate change was designed to scare you into giving up your car, you know, and your single family home because you wanted to reduce emissions and save the planet. Well, of course, the planet's doing just fine. This is the interesting thing that ties all of this together. The energy, the solar, the wind, the, you know, the car fuel, the electricity, the home, the everything, you know, all this stuff, this work environment stuff, it's all based on the lie that carbon dioxide is bad. Everything hinges on that. If you question whether carbon dioxide is bad, everything else falls apart. So all the climate change falls apart once you realize that carbon dioxide is good. Gregory Wrightstone, one of the biggest proponents of that, he has the CO2 Coalition. He's busy now. He used to come on the show more, but now he's busy. And he's like national huge figure. So I'll try and drag him on at some point soon. But if you believe that, then you don't have to go to a net zero situation. So this is a big thing right now. You're going to hear more and more about this net zero. In other words, no carbon dioxide being produced, none. Well, that's irrational because anytime you burn any of the abiotic petroleum sources, oil, coal, natural gas, things like that, they produce carbon dioxide and water vapor, which condenses. You know, water vapor condenses and the carbon dioxide feeds the plants. Well, plus some other things that aren't so good, you know, nitrogen monoxide, sulfur monoxide, which become nitrogen dioxide and sulfur dioxide and various other. There are actual pollutants, you know, in exhaust, but it's so much less than there used to be, you know, 30, 40 years ago. But the thing is, a lot of what's produced is carbon dioxide. Carbon monoxide comes out of the tailpipe, and when it cools, it binds with another oxygen atom and forms carbon dioxide. Plant food. Same thing with water vapor. And you see all those jet contrails in the sky, those big white trails everybody thinks are chemtrails? That's water vapor. It comes out of the tailpipe as ice when it gets high enough because the water vapor freezes instantly because it's too cold up there. So what you're seeing are billions of tiny frozen ice crystals, not chemicals. Chemicals couldn't survive up there either, most of them. They'd freeze too. It'd be suspended in the air just like the water vapor. So it's really quite fascinating. Anyway, so once you believe, once you get over the lie that carbon dioxide is bad for the planet, everything else falls apart. So basing our entire future on a net zero, no carbon emission thing of a totally electric environment of channeling everybody into these particular homes and home offices and making you work from home and not having you commute, not having you have that private car unless it's an electric one, and then metering how much electricity you get, rationing. Government's all about rationing. Then this all falls apart. But I'm just sort of going over, I'm trying to figure out, this is why it may sound a little confused today, because I'm trying to figure out how much is on purpose and how much is by accident and how much is opportunistic out of COVID, which is opportunistic. So a bunch of big pharma, government, big media, big tech people can make untold billions of dollars. But let's get back to the basic level. If you have to make a decision, well, there's an entire industry that's springing up to help you create your home office. And this is just one of these websites right here. This is perhaps you started a new job that allows more remote flexibility, or maybe you're among the many Americans who have found out they aren't returning to the office anytime soon or ever. It's kind of an ultimatum there, right? It says if you're in either category, you should be thinking about the long-term plan for your home workspace. Notice how they join that together. Your home workspace, okay? You have your work space, and you have your home workspace. Again, this isn't political and sexy, and it isn't the southern border, isn't Biden's an idiot and all this other. This is real world. Everybody is affected by this. Okay, this is why I think it's so fascinating that everybody at some point. I'm affected by this. I do a lot of work from home, and a lot of people do now. It's quite fascinating how this is all working out. Anyway, it says it may not be a full fledged home office at that point, but the space where your work day to be set up for physical comfort, ergonomics, and workday inspiration design. So they're going to be consultants for this. You're going to have, you get your feng shui, you get your feng shui home and office people. You're going to have people specializing in home and office stuff. It's going to be fascinating. It says even better if it looks and feels a lot like the rest of your home. So what they're actually going to do is design, this is going to be the future, okay? This is what I'm predicting, that home offices are going to look like some hybrid of a home and an office. It's not going to be like a sterile office, but it's not going to be like your living room either. You have a nice desk, ergonomic chair. You're going to have plants all over the place. You're going to have probably your stereo playing, maybe your TV for news or documentaries or research or tutorials for your business. You're going to have all kinds of stuff set up, and it's going to have your coffee warmer, maybe a coffee pot in your home office. You don't have to go all the way to the kitchen. I don't know. The world's changing. And I'm just fascinated by how this works. All right. So let me get to, I think I might save net zero for another day because that's going to be a whole show in itself as to how we're moving. But let's get back to the people I'm most suspicious about, the World Economic Forum, because the World Economic Forum seems to be documenting this rather well. And what I find fascinating is, again, these are the people that brought you Event 201, the precursor to COVID, where they rehearsed exactly how they were going to suppress information, suppress early treatments, manage the crisis that they're creating, and probably spread the disease too. I don't know. That was pure speculation. But why they're so carefully documenting this is, I guess, to appear as an authority on the subject as they lead you to net zero, where they're going to say you can't have any source but electricity. You can't produce any carbon dioxide, even though plants are dependent on it. Therefore, we're dependent on it. Okay, because plants produce oxygen and plants produce food. Plants are our best friend. You get rid of the plants, you got a problem. And this is from the people that wanted to preserve the rainforest. Well, the best way to preserve the rainforest is to put as much carbon dioxide into the environment as possible. So obviously that's not the goal then. All right. The idea of producing as much ethanol as possible, taking our CO2 and putting it into corn oil, making your cars run on salad dressing as opposed to petroleum that the earth makes anyway. That doesn't make any sense. These contradictions I find fascinating. Anyway, so let's get to this. This is World Economic Forum. It's under the global agenda, workforce and employment, future of work, subsection, the title of the article, Home Office HQ, hybrid or work from home or work from anywhere. This is what businesses are planning. And it's the 31st of May, 2021. So this is last year. Gail Markowitz, business editor, World Economic Forum. Understand that this is the folks with the, these are the folks with the Great Reset. This is purely a political organization. It's a globalist world government organization. I mean, the World Economic Forum did most of the stuff for COVID, which is fascinating because why would COVID be based on economics and not medicine and science? That's, you know, why is the source of most of the COVID information the World Economic Forum? That alone should tell you something. Anyway, the article says there is a global debate raging about the future of the office. Raging? Really? The pandemic has seen office working life upended for the world's 1.25 billion knowledge workers. Now, here's a new term. Do you know what a knowledge worker is? This is those people who have spent much of the past 18 months at home in front of a screen. Of course, this is last year, so this is over 2 years now. So if you're, there's knowledge workers. There's two ways to work. They say brain or brawn. Use your muscles, you know, construction, that kind of stuff, or you use your brain, you know, accounting. Yeah. So that's how it works. Are you a brain worker or are you a brawn worker? All right. Anyway, it says, so as vaccination programs are rolled out, right, you mean mandated, and economies in some countries are able to reopen. Yeah, some countries never shut down, pal. You know, as his businesses are starting to redefine the future for their office workers. The context is that in 2020, well, here's an interesting thing too. How about blue-collar workers? Well, most blue-collar workers either work outside or work, you know, they'll have like a plumber will have an office, but most of their work is in homes and in offices. You know, so they've been doing this for, I mean, those folks have been working from home, you know, or basing at home, or they'll have like an office, you know, like a storefront. But a lot of the work is done in other people's homes. So they're working outside all the time anyway. They're not working in that one central office. They're moving all over. So it's fascinating. Blue-collar workers, and I'm not sure how they're going to be affected by all this. It's going to be interesting, considering we need more of blue-collar workers. All right. The context, back to the article. The context is that in 2020, the global workforce lost an equivalent of 255 million full-time jobs. Let me say that again. 2020, the global workforce lost an equivalent of 255 million full-time jobs. What do you mean lost? You mean were stolen. Okay, this is why this is political, right? It says an estimated $3.7 trillion in wages were lost and 4.4% of global GDP. Remote work has only been available to a largely well-paid minority. Yeah, so it's the rich, right? The emptying of offices, however, has left city centers deserted with profound impacts on urban economies. This is where I got some of the stuff I talked about earlier. Okay, and you can see it right here. You know, it says businesses that serve office workers, the cafes, dry cleaners, and sandwich shops have been grounded. There are big questions about the future of urban mobility as commuters have stayed at home. Residential and commercial rents in urban centers have been dropping, and consumption patterns are changing. Sales of home office equipment are soaring, whereas fewer people are spending on transport. And that's why I say, is this by design? You know, because they don't want people in their cars. They don't want people commuting. They don't want people burning gasoline. They don't want people, you know, I don't even know if they want electric cars on the road because, you know, you're on the road, and the road's petroleum, you know, and it keeps going. Anyway, they talk about digitalization. The office had it coming. The writing has been on the wall since the term telecommuting came about in the early 1970s. Digitalization promised a new era for working life, but the cultural transformation lagged until COVID-19, which makes me think a lot of this is on purpose. In other words, you weren't doing what they wanted you to do, the smart growth, the urban planners, the engineers, you know, the social engineers. You weren't doing what they wanted you to do. You know, and then they tried to scare you with climate change, and it worked for a lot of people, but it didn't work for enough people. So they really scared people with COVID to get you to do what they wanted all along. Give up your car, give up your home, turn your home into an office, don't go anywhere, stay isolated, stay controlled, use one energy source, electricity, and you have a completely channeled program population. I'm just looking at the patterns. This is what I see. So where do you go with this? All right. I don't know. I've got more articles, but this is one of the ones I found to be quite fascinating. Let me get down to the, you know, and they go through a bunch of stuff, social waves, you know, they have all this other information. They have they have an interesting little chart here on percent of working week expected to spend versus wanted to spend in the following environments after COVID-19. I don't know Dr. Fascist doesn't want to get rid of COVID-19 ever. He's, you know, masks. Philadelphia, what's the problem with Philadelphia? They know masks don't work, yet they're mandating them anyway. It's so stupid. Anyway, so the expected allocation of time, according to the chart here, 69% office, 27% home. All right. What people want, though, is 51% office, 45% home. That's the ideal allocation. So it's interesting that people still want to spend more time at home than they do in the office. And they got a bunch of different articles, charts, da, 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 da. Let's get down to innovation. That would be interesting. And this is still the same old stuff. All right. But where really, where it really gets interesting is the last part where it says doing it right. Okay. This is the conclusion of this World Economic Forum article. The big lesson from the work from home revolution is that progress is not always linear and not always fair. Fair? Okay, here we go, right? You know what's coming, okay? Offices don't necessarily get bigger, city centers may not get denser, and the infinite expansion of transport infrastructure might need a rethink. Let me translate that for you. Offices don't necessarily get bigger, which means people don't need to go to work. Commercial real estate, all the associated businesses, the economy, the city economy, the private economy is shrinking. Well, that means the government economy is going to increase, all right? Next part, city centers may not get denser. Why would you want a city center denser? Well, infill, smart growth. You know, the more people you can pack into the fewer space or the least amount of space and have them do everything from home and work and public transit for the rest of the stuff, because cars are impractical in big cities. So if you have really dense city centers, you know, where people live, work, and they live in apartments and they work in office buildings that are next door or even in their home now, you know, then it's like may not get denser implies to me they want to make them denser. You know, maybe where they're going to put these 2 million illegal aliens that they're packing into our country. And then it says, and the infinite expansion of transport infrastructure might need a rethink. Infinite expansion of transport infrastructure? In other words, we don't need the roads as much. We don't need the highways as much. You know, we just do public transit. And if people are at home all the time, we don't need any transit because they're at home all the time. You see, again. And then it says, if there is a red line through the latest developments, it is that the hybrid work revolution could address social inequity and provide a more inclusive recovery for all if it's done right. Okay, what are they saying? You know what they're saying. You know exactly what the social inequity. So where does social inequity come into the discussion of the hybrid work and home environment? Well, because some people can afford, you know, home and work and some people can't. You know, in other words, our disadvantaged minority population needs equity. So are we going to be buying homes for people and converting, you know, office rooms for people of various minority groups? Are we going to transfer wealth from those that can't afford it to those that can't, like they're trying to do with student loans? In other words, they're rewarding people who didn't pay back their loans and they're punishing people who did by trying to forgive. Is that forgiving? Making a loan is not a sin. It's not a crime. The term forgiving a loan is what they're really doing is bailing you out. It's a bailout. It's a mass bailout because when government took over the student loans, they also took over the canceling of student loans, you know, and it's a very interesting thing. We'll see how this works. But basically, you punish the people that paid them back. Well, they're going to want restitution. So you're creating a huge amount of enemies. In other words, everything that's responsible, you know, coming to the country legally, you know, working hard, paying your taxes, doing the right thing, you know, is all out the window because now they will reward people who come to the country illegally. And all the crimes are the crimes the government commits and everything they're doing is rewarded. Look at the FBI. Anyway, this whole idea of social inequity and provide a more inclusive recovery for all, if it's done right. Well, what does that really mean? That's the big question. What does that really mean? How do we take the work home revolution to address social inequity and provide an inclusive recovery for all? See, the word inclusive to me means everybody gets the same thing. Well, that's communism. You know, everybody gets the same amount of electricity. Everybody gets the same amount of wealth. Everybody gets the same amount of space to live in. Everybody gets the same amount of energy to use. Everybody gets the same. Now we're all inclusive, right? No, we're all slaves to a master system where they get as much as they want. All right, here's a different one. Expat Go. I think that's the sort of logo is hard to read, but that's what this website looks like. This is an article by Chad Merchant, April 13th, 2022. So this is last week. So now let's see what the take on it is a year later. It says this is from their economy section. Home office, the hybrid work model is here to stay, but are we ready for it? And this is where it gets interesting, right? Now, some of the things I talked about earlier in this article too. So I like to quote my sources. It says one of the most appealing results of the still ongoing pandemic, still ongoing. Yeah, we haven't gotten rid of it yet. It should have been 4 months, but you know they've milked it for all it's worth, and now they're talking about a fourth booster. Oh, that was one of the things in the news too. It's kind of interesting that they're talking about a fourth shot, and the way the FDA did that is they got rid of the people who were going to vote against it. They just got rid of them. Sorry, we're not going to do that. We're not going to take a vote this time. So they, this is a Fox News story. I don't know all the details, but it looks like the FDA has totally violated normal procedures, which COVID, that's what COVID's all about, and said they're not going to take a vote. They're not going to listen to experts who say you don't need a fourth shot. Because you don't. I mean, most people now have had COVID, so they don't need any shots. But most people never did. That's why they never tested for antibodies. They never tested for COVID immunity before giving you a shot, because they would quickly have discovered, or they would have quickly had to deal with the fact that most people are already immune because they had COVID. You know, so giving a vaccine, giving a person a so-called vaccine with all the associated health effects, including death, you know, to people that are already immune is medical malpractice. That's why they didn't test you. So now you can't say that. If you took a jab before you were tested for immunity, it's kind of on you, unfortunately. Anyway, back to the article here. As the pandemic began to spread across the world in early 2020, remote working arrangements, along with things like distance learning, virtual meetings, and more, were forced on societies by sheer necessity. Well, I would question, but let's go with it for now. This is by some point the following year. While the pandemic was still raging, the consensus that, quote, remote work is here to stay had already begun to emerge. Increasingly, as the immediacy of the crisis fades and restrictions are relaxed, businesses will not be faced with choosing where employees do their work. Well, also, employees are going to be choosing a lot too. Trust me, I know that by which companies they work. It says now the need of tools, expectations, and experiences. Employees are also feeling empowered to have a say, just like I said, right, as well, leading to what has been called the Great Resignation in a number of countries as people seek to find a better balance between work and life and a job that will accommodate that balance. For some, the move to hybrid working can be difficult, both physically and emotionally. Workers basically have to maintain two work environments, office and home, and the line between work ends and work begins often shifts from blurred to non-existent. You're almost never truly off from work. That's the point I made earlier. This is where I got it from, right? So, you're never off work. You're always working, because if you work from home and you live at home, you're always at work. Companies are going to use that. It says, yet still, every indication is that while hybrid working may not become wholly ubiquitous, traditional offices aren't all going to disappear. The concept one person for businesses is definitely The concept as one option for businesses is definitely here to stay. As published by future author Mark Andreessen, A-N-D-R-E-E-S-S-E-N, a lot of extra letters there, we're undergoing a permanent civilian shift. A permanent civilizational shift where we can divorce, quote, physical location from economic opportunity. In the long term, that assessment is likely so, but are we prepared to fully embrace it now? Today, a few point to that high questionable. Yeah, and this is move out of the cities. So who are they trying to move out of the cities and who are trying to move in? Are they moving people out of the cities to make room for all the illegals? You know, to have a subservient peasant class voting in the cities for Democrats? I don't know. What are our cities going to become? Here's an article called The Emergence of the City-State, where I had a plan where major leftist, basically, cities would become their own city-state. They would have their own taxes. They would be fully supporting. They couldn't tax people outside in the state. Like in California, BART, the Bay Area Rapid Transit System, a highly unionized, incredibly expensive, money-losing, as far as I know, because they have a big budget too, right? They can't support. If they have a budget, they're not supporting themselves, right? So they're losing money. The BART system is funded by taxpayers all over California. So if you live in a farm in Northern California, you know, part of your taxes pay for transportation so San Franciscans, you know, can get to work. Well, they shouldn't have to do that. That should be paid for by San Franciscans, and it should be a self-supporting system. That's why if it was a city-state, it would be a self-supporting economy. You know, and the congressional boundaries would be drawn within the city-state. And you have congressional boundaries outside the city-state, which would be the rural population. You'd have two senators per state. One senator would represent the city-states, and one senator would represent the rest of the state. Okay? All these things we play with here, all these concepts. Anyway, so we shall see how this works. I'll see if I want to read any more of this. A lot of our business tools are hybrid friendly. Major tech companies will make it. Okay, get it up. You get the idea. There's not much more I want to say on that. And this is pretty much all I want to say for now, because I have to explore more of this. But I think it's going to be very interesting to see where this goes. We've got to design place. Let me see. I've got another. Oh, here's another article. Office, hybrid, or home, the future of work for local governments. There's another one. So they're looking at this angle too. This is Atar Nadiri, UK business manager, Laserfish, explores how local governments are preparing for hybrid working post-COVID. So this is a British angle. So I've got articles. You can find articles from all over the world on this. It's really quite fascinating. So let me just start this one, and then I'll move on to other stuff. This is from remote working to hybrid working. Local governments are faced with the pressure to clarify their stance on working practices in the UK while upholding this position for their own employees. Whether voluntary or mandated, many government organizations are seeing a high volume of internal and public-facing requests, which leave businesses and workers confused and left scrambling to determine what is next post-pandemic. Well, what post-pandemic should be, you know, this shouldn't be a problem for anybody. Go to whatever we were doing, you know, pre-pandemic. So in other words, this quote pandemic was always designed for a permanent change, is what it looks like. If you're talking post-pandemic, anything different than pre-pandemic, then you're using the plandemic, the whole COVID thing, for a new design. That's a problem, I think. The article says public sector leaders recognize that to get the most out of their employees, local authorities need to support digital ways of working over the long term. All right, this is the future article here, the future of work within central government research. Okay, 91% of government decision makers agree that working from home will be a commonplace post-pandemic. Employees in a variety of organizations are also requesting the ability to retain the benefits of flexible working once restrictions are lifted further. And this one's from pretty recently, too. Let me see if I got this article written. August 2nd, 2021. So this is actually, no, it's closer to a year ago. Anyway, you get the idea. And again, more questions than answers. Of course, the big one is going to be when we start tackling net zero. I'll probably do that tomorrow. I got another article here from office hybrid or work from home, a guide for small businesses. So there's an article here as to how they do it. It says, now that you know how to relocate your small business and your employees, it's time to decide whether your workforce will work from home and office or use a hybrid arrangement. And they just, you know, they talk about all the things, you know, pluses from home, pluses from work, all that kind of stuff. I've posted most of these on Facebook, you have to be a friend to see them. But, you know, you can find this. This is in the website Guidant, G-U-I-D-A-N-T, Office, Hybrid, or Work from Home, a Guide for Small Businesses. So you can find it. You know, this is why I quote my sources, so you can find them pretty easily. All right, I think I've talked enough. I'm going to sort of plow through this. And you get the basic idea. Again, is this World Economic Forum and globalist planning to get people out of work, to reduce emissions, to get to this net zero carbon thing, to channel people into homes so they're more easily controlled, to put us all on electric power only, you know, to meter our power and just have a completely controlled environment. That's what I'm guessing. I don't think they're going to be successful at it because we still have free will. And especially as things like Action Radio and more things get organized, it's going to be very interesting to see what happens in terms of the resistance. You know, that's us. We're the resistance. And a bunch of other folks are the resistance, too. And there's more of it going on all the time. I just hope to be have most of the ideas for the resistance. That's what we're working on here. All right, so it's a little bit past the hour. It's 7:03. I'm going to play you a couple things. And, well, actually, let me get right to the interview, and then I'll play some stuff afterwards. And this, so let me just set this up. And so it's going to take us pretty much up to when Peter Pry joins us at the top of the hour. And then I'm going to have more. I got more stories for you on different topics. But I think I've kind of explained this one about as well as can be explained right now. So, again, Dr. Roger Roots, who I hope to work more with on judicial reform bills for Action Radio that we present to Congress. The big one being congressional oversight procedure over the Supreme Court to make sure they're conforming to terms of good behavior per Article 3. That in itself is going to be hugely controversial. The other one that will be hugely controversial is the idea of Supreme Court juries. So once the Supreme Court issues an opinion, it goes to a jury of the people who then issue an opinion on that. So it gets even more interesting. Why? Well, because the people are superior to the government. So we have to have a jury superior to the Supreme Court. Oh, won't that be interesting? We'll talk more about that. So anyway, there was an organization, I haven't heard as much from them lately, but they were bigger, I think, several years ago, called FIJA. That's F-I-J-A, the Fully Informed Jury Association. And I remember seeing this stuff when I went for jury trials. They'd hand you information saying you have the right to judge the laws, not just the facts of the case. And, of course, the judge says you have no right to judge the laws, only the facts of the case, and you have to follow my instructions. Well, none of what that judge instruction is true. In fact, judges shouldn't even be issuing instructions. Anyway, so I had Dr. Roots on. And again, you'll hear references to the Bundy case, which I think we talked about in a subsequent interview. I think I'll dig that one up too. But you should know what you do before you serve on a jury. And if every American knew the powers of the jury, that should be a required course. You know, before you ever spend a jury, you should have to spend at least, I don't know, an hour. It wouldn't take long to fully educate the jury before they go in, saying you have the right to nullify the laws. You have a right to, you know, do all kinds. You have a right to write an opinion. You know, jury should be issuing opinions on the cases that they do. The foreman and the other folks should be writing a document that goes along with the case. You know, and so they can only say so much because jury proceedings are secret, but they could still, you know, render a verdict. You know, saying the judge didn't give us enough options. We wanted a lesser crime and they wouldn't do it. Or we wanted different options. Or we wanted to clarify the law and the judge wouldn't let us see the Constitution. I mean, that happens. You know, all these things happen. Anyway, let me just play this for you. You know, so we're going to go back to January 13th. I wonder if it was a Friday. Anyway, not January, excuse me, July. July 13th of 2017. So I'm still fairly new in my my radio biz. And ramble even more than I did just the last hour. So, yeah, listen to this. Tell me what you think in the end. Our phone number here. So if you hear references to WEBY or the 850 phone number, those are this part of the recording. It just would have been messy and choppy if I take every one of those out. I took out the ads, took out the news breaks, took out you know, a bunch of stuff and just left you with 43 minutes of what was a 60-minute show. And so, again, you know, our number here, 215-383-3832. You can get us on live chat. We also have the Skype line, and so whatever you want to communicate. Live chat's a good way to communicate during this presentation because it's going to take most of this hour to do. So let me get started, and I'll be back after this presentation. Oh, yeah. I've wanted to do this show for a long time. And so nothing infuriates me more than the continued misinformation that goes on from the judiciary saying they have the power of judicial review and from the lack of knowledge people have over the fact that, you know, juries are people have no idea the power they have in a jury and judges are continually misinforming them. And that's how the show came about. So I have a very special guest I want to introduce right now. He is an attorney, sociologist, and libertarian activist. He is a legal advisor to the Fully Informed Jury Association. He has taught criminal justice at the university level and worked on high-profile federal criminal cases, currently working on the Clive and Bundy defense. And we're going to talk about that one day, too. He is the author of a book, The Conviction Factory, The Collapse of America's Criminal Courts. It's available on Amazon. Please welcome my special guest, Dr. Roger Roots. Yeah. Dr. Roots, how you doing?
I'm doing very well.
All right. So go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here.
Oh, good, good. Because I'm really glad to have you here because this started, I had an epic debate a couple of weeks ago with the caller named Joel, who's got 40 years of attorney experience, which is great. But he is of the contention that juries have to follow the judge's instructions and they can't rule on the law and the Supreme Court laws are, you know, whatever they say goes and the Constitution is subservient to that. And we just have to get this misinformation out, you know, as much as we can. So if you can tell me a little bit about you, what you're working on, and FEJA, let's get started with that.
Yeah, FEJA is the Fully Informed Jury Association. FEJA.org is the website. And it's the oldest and largest organization that is totally dedicated to educating jurors and potential jurors, which means really any American. There is a problem in criminal justice. There's a problem in the criminal courts. Just like you said, the legal profession is filled with people, and you find them especially in the prosecution and the judges, who honestly believe that juries are never supposed to think about the law. They're only supposed to think about the so-called facts of a criminal trial, okay?
Yep.
And so you will see at the end of a lot of criminal trials in most jurisdictions, the judge will instruct the jurors, you must follow my interpretation of the law. If you find that the government met its burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt, you must find the defendant guilty. And, of course, it's not true. It's an absolute lie. The juries have always had the right to declare not guilty for any reason, even in the face of overwhelming, insurmountable evidence.
I went to a court case. You know, I was in a jury myself. This is years ago, and I didn't have time to serve on the jury. But I remember saying to the judge, "Judge gets up and says exactly that: that you have no power to decide what the law is. You have to decide just based on the facts of the case. We will tell you what the law is." And I raised my hand and said, "Judge, with all due respect, sir, you're wrong." I said, "I know about the Fully Informed Jury Association." I said this in open court, right? And I said that, it was classic. It was hysterical. And I said, "No, I'm going to judge the law. I'm going to judge the Constitution. And if the law complies with the Constitution, then they'll, you know, I'll rule on that basis." And I said, "And if the law is wrong, if it's not just, then I'm going to certainly interpret the law." And he looks at me and says, "Well, you're just going to apply any law you want? You're going to do whatever you feel like?" I said, "No, not at all." But it's, and I had this tradition, you know, of the jurors doing this, and it all got screwed up somehow. But I said, "But that's what juries have the power to do." And I look at everybody in the courtroom and say, "You can decide the law. The judge is a public servant. He works for the government." I said, "We are the people. We are supreme to the government." And I said, "And that's on that basis, I'll decide the law." And he looks at me and says, "Greg, you're excused." And with a standing ovation, I walked out the door. But that's the state of law. So that's what I'm up against.
Yep. And that happens all over the country. And it did not used to be that way. All through the 1800s, probably well into the mid-1900s, the common way to instruct jurors is, the judge tells you what the law is. Most jurors want to hear the judge tell them the law. They want to know the little specifics of the law. What's the difference between burglary and robbery? What's the difference between first-degree murder and second-degree murder, et cetera? The jurors want to know the law, but in the end, it is up to the jury to choose to apply it or not, or to give mercy. It is up to the jurors. And if the government proves its case beyond a reasonable doubt, that is not the last question. That doesn't end the analysis for the jurors. By constitutional design, the jury is supposed to be a check on government, not just a fact-finding mechanism. And what has happened over the course of legal history is that the legal profession has sort of waged war, and I'll just say the judiciary especially.
Mm-hmm.
Judges don't like the fact that juries can second-guess them. For example, let's say a hypothetical example where a judge thinks that a particular gun law is perfectly fine, it's constitutional. Oh, yeah, there's that thing called the Second Amendment, but, well, the law in question is somehow consistent with the Second Amendment right to bear arms. The judge might think that, but it is up to any individual juror to say, "Well, is that true? Let me think about it." It's up to the jury, not the judge.
Well, this has been a huge criticism, and it's funny you bring up Second Amendment because I wanted to talk about this, you know, as well. Because when I used to live in California, I'm Florida now, but in California, you know, it was always kind of like my dream to get on a Second Amendment case and have somebody defending their home or carrying arms in public or something like that, and say, "Well, the law says you can't do that. You can't have a permit because the government decides on a good cause reason for having it." And I would get up in the jury and say, "No, this is wrong. The Second Amendment says you have the uninfringable right to own and carry any firearm." Now, it doesn't say you have the right to use it anyway, but you do have the right to own and carry it, and the government can't touch that, and I would rule on that basis. And but it never happened, of course, but that's what's going on with Second Amendment cases. We could overturn all these laws by having juries simply refuse to convict and just go strictly by the Second Amendment.
Yeah, and believe it or not, it does happen. Even though, like I said, the judges falsely instruct the jurors at every level. Some states are better than others, frankly. The federal level is horrible. The federal judges, I mean, I'm not kidding, it's horrible. They will actually just emphasize the word must.
Yeah.
They'll say, "If you find that the government proved its case, you must find the defendant guilty." They'll actually emphasize the word must.
Why don't we arrest them? Can we get rid of these judges?
Listen, it's almost by collusion. I won't say conspiracy. It's almost by this mutual sort of understanding. If you go through 3 years of law school and then you're either elected or appointed to a judge position, it's this sort of mutual understanding that you know the law better than a common person.
Mm-hmm.
And after you go through 3 years of law school, you look at a courtroom differently. You look at the judge in the courtroom as the master or the superior, and you look at the jurors, who really are the superior by constitutional design, as people that need to follow instructions.
Mm-hmm.
And the opposite is true. The founding fathers intended that the jurors, which are a sort of a perennial check on government, you could say another branch of government in some ways. It is the jurors whose highest duty is to act as a check on government and in some ways to be master over the judge, not the other way around.
Well, that's what I thought. The judge is like a referee. They make sure that they explain the various punishments, you know, between, like you said, first degree and second degree murder. They make sure that the rules of evidence are followed. They make sure that the objections and things are done and the trial is conducted properly. But they do not interpret the law, because to interpret is to change, as far as I'm concerned. They do not tell the juries what they can and can't do. That's not their responsibility. And I got a great quote here from the FIJA website. So if you want to go to this, F-I-J-A, that's FIJA.org, and it says, the primary function of the independent juror is not, as many think, to dispense punishment to fellow citizens accused of breaking various laws, but rather to protect fellow citizens from tyrannical abuses of power by government. The Constitution guarantees you the right to trial by jury. This means that government must bring its case before a jury of the people. If government wants to deprive any person of life, liberty, or property, jurors can say no to government tyranny by refusing to convict.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. So what are you working on? Do you have any cases of Profija that you're working on right now? Other than, I know you're doing the Clive and Bundy thing.
Well, actually, you know, FIJA is always looking for test case, the case that might go to the Supreme Court and lay down this rule as clearly as ever. See, the problem is that there have been, over time, over the generations, a series of close cases and split decisions at the United States Supreme Court. And, you know, some judges say, well, you know, sure, the jurors have the power to nullify. Sure, the jurors have the power to declare not guilty in any case and for any reason. Mm-hmm. Sure, that's true, but the judges shouldn't tell them. They shouldn't be informed that they have that power.
How did that come about? Where did we go wrong? Where did judges get this? I mean, they always had a superior attitude, but where was the change from the founding fathers, which said that the jurors are, I mean, in common law precedent, you're supposed to test the laws in court cases, and juries are supposed to rule on those laws. How did we get from there to judges being these supreme people, where one little federal judge in the middle of nowhere totally overturns, like, the presidential travel ban, things like that? Where did we go wrong?
It's been very gradual. It didn't happen all at once. Like I said, all through the 1800s, it was understood, and the judges would tell the jurors, "Yeah, you are the judge of the law and the facts."
Yeah.
But by the end of the 1800s, you know, there started to be this organized legal profession that thought it needed a little bit more authority, you know. And so, there was a Supreme Court case around the end of the 1800s. And it was called Sparf and Hansen versus the United States. Anyway, it's a very long case. It has multiple concurrences, dissents, et cetera. It was a split decision. And the question there was, in a murder case, does the jury have a right to know that they can convict for manslaughter? All right, now, that's sort of a jury nullification type question.
Yeah.
And it is true, by the way, in a murder case, the jury has a right to go with a manslaughter conviction, not a murder conviction. In that case, though, there was a question of whether the jury needed to be informed. And it's funny, there was the judges on the U.S. Supreme Court battled. I mean, it was a very long case with lots of a split decision with different opinions on the question. And then, but it ultimately came out, well, the judges don't need to fully inform them. And then from that decision on, it's gotten a little bit worse, frankly. And if you do polling among lawyers, like that lawyer you talked about at the beginning, you'll find those that believe that the jury, the commoners, are never supposed to even think about the constitutionality of the laws that they are applying. They're never supposed to think about the law, never supposed to think about overarching questions of mercy or abuse by the prosecution. Never supposed to think about it. Yeah. They're just supposed to decide on the facts. The bar, the organized legal profession, is probably, I'd hate to say it, it's at least two-thirds against us. In other words, I would estimate two-thirds of all lawyers believe the jury has to be kept in the dark and just deceived in this way. The public, of course, is on our side.
Yeah.
The public, you do polling, overwhelmingly believes in the right of the jury to act as a check on government when I told my mother's an educated person, and mm-hmm. I told her once that, oh, you're not even supposed to read the Constitution when you sit on the jury. I told my mother that according to current law that now is imposed in most federal courtrooms and state, I told my mother, well, according to most judges, you're not even supposed to read the Constitution while you sit on a jury. They don't want you to look at the Constitution. She was shocked.
Yeah.
She couldn't believe it.
I think
that's the reaction that most people have. But the judges in this country at most levels honestly believe that the jurors are not supposed to even consider or even read the Constitution when they deliberate.
Wow. We're going to take a little break now. When we come back, I want to sort of give you my description of what I call judge world and lawyer world. It's how I explain it. And I want to tell you about Action Radio, how I'm hoping to empower our citizenry not only to be fully informed jurors, but actually to write legislation on this show. And so I think it's going to be quite fun. My special guest is Dr. Roger Roots, legal advisor to the Fully Informed Jury Association. It's 8:20 in the morning, and we will be right back. Talking about fully informed juries. Court is now in session. That's A-Dog, the world's greatest producer, Dr. Roots. He has appropriate music for any occasion.
Right.
That's what makes it fun around here. So I want to talk about and see if this makes sense to you. The way I explain things here, there's like attorney world, which you're in. First of all, it's law school world. And so you go into this rarefied atmosphere, just like you were saying before. You learn how to be a lawyer, and you learn how to trust other lawyers and judgment, and you sort of ignore the people because you're a lawyer. You know more about the law than anybody else. Then you get into attorney world, which is even a more rarefied group. And then if you get appointed to a judge, you're in judge world, which is even a more select group from that. And every step up the ladder, you get more increasing power and more arrogance and more corruption, and you sort of feel that you know everything. And I was listening to Neil Gorsuch in the confirmation hearings. I'm not a big fan of his because he was talking about, because he listened to two things on, he says, you know, marriage law is already settled, referring to the Supreme Court's case saying that gay marriage is okay and the states can't take it up anymore. It's not settled at all. It isn't even begun to be settled. And the other one was he was talking about the Second Amendment. He says, well, I'm going to follow, you know, the law, the case law as determined by the Supreme Court. That's nonsense too, because most of the Supreme Court cases completely infringe on the Second Amendment all the time. So he is a judge that is more in favor of case law over the Constitution. So I don't know if people picked up on that. Check the hearings out again and see what you think. But judge world, does that kind of make sense how that whole arrogance thing works?
Well, you nailed it. You totally nailed it. I can tell you.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right. And as you go, you know, one point you made that I completely agree with, and it's a subtle point, but as lawyers go up in the hierarchy, they get worse. In other words, the judges, the people who make it to the judge level, are the worst of the worst.
Wow.
In terms of trusting government, being comfortable with government authority over others. It is that group, you know, it's hard to get a libertarian on the bench. It almost never happens. There are so many barriers to that. What you get on the bench as judges are those who are the most trustful of the state.
That's the scariest thing I think I've ever heard on this show. And it really is. And first of all, I want to invite callers to call in. If you've ever been called for jury duty, if you have a story for us, if you're about to be called or you've been called already for jury duty, if you just want to learn what to do on a jury, you know, if you have a case in particular where something happened in court that you can talk about, I'd love to hear from you at 623-1330. So feel free to give us a shout. Dr. Roots, what I want to do is turn talk radio into action radio. And the whole point of that is to empower people. And when we talk about the Constitution, I mentioned that I don't read what other people have written about the Constitution. I don't want to be slandered by that. I just read the Constitution. It's written in plain language. It's accessible to anybody. You don't have to be an attorney to read it. You don't have to be a judge to interpret it. It says we the people, not what we the elite judges will tell you. Okay? And so we're going to actually write bills on the air. And the website's in the process. It's going to be out fairly soon. I know I keep saying that, but it's really complex. Anyway, but we're going to start doing that, and people are going to be empowered not only to be fully informed jurors, but to write their own laws, because my whole guiding principle is that the people give their consent to be governed through writing the laws by which they are governed, and that is a brand new legal theory that basically I came up with. That's what's going to govern my show. What do you think?
I think it's a great idea. Wow, that is a great idea.
Yeah. Well, good, stay informed, because I'm going to need your help when it comes to jury laws.
Yeah.
Okay, now here's another one. Go ahead. All right.
I was going to say, with regard to the jury issues, you know, some states have tried things such as laws on the books that require, you know, bills to require that judges tell jurors of their power.
Yeah, I got one of those,
and, yeah, you know, and they go up, you know, it's the kind of a thing that has had some very, very limited success in a couple states.
Mm-hmm.
New Hampshire has passed something that's a little bit watered down. But anyway, ultimately, you know, it would be great if you know, bills are passed. You know, by the way, other people on the FIJA board disagree with this because
I know, I've talked to them, yeah.
It's hopeless. Don't even go to legislatures and try to get any change because it's hopeless. I actually think that it's, you know, there is some hope.
Okay.
One thing about it is there needs to be laws that specify that if the judge falsely instructs the jury, that is a mistrial and absolute reversible error on appeal.
Oh, I
love
it.
That clause has to be in there.
Okay. Well, this is why I need your help when I start drafting legislation. I'll tell you about my mandatory jury instruction in a second. But Gino's calling. I want to get him on the line right now to put his point here. So, Gino, go ahead.
Hey, I just, every time I hear somebody that, you know, knows something about laws and the court system, what do you feel about the minimum mandatory sentencing that, you know, that we have now that, you know, a judge, that nobody has any say-so. You get X amount of years, period.
I think that's more legislation, yeah. But Dr. Roots, what do you think?
It's definitely an issue that you... Well, one thing about it, you've seen that kind of thing, and that goes way back.
Okay.
There's a long history of that. It's terrible. I can tell you I'm working on the Bundy case, which some of your listeners probably are aware of. It's this case in Nevada where the feds came in and tried to round up all these cows on the desert that belonged to Clive and Bundy. And anyway, there was sort of a standoff, and the feds claimed that they were scared and gave up the cows. Now they're charging these guys with all of these mandatory minimum firearm federal charges.
Right.
And if convicted, these guys are looking at potentially life in prison, and there are mandatory minimum sentences all through that indictment. So if they're convicted of a particular count, it's mandatory minimum 7 years in federal prison. If they're convicted of another count, which is a duplicate, using firearms in a crime of violence, mandatory minimum 25 years to life. And then there's a third count of the same charge. So I'm dealing with that kind of thing all the time. It is very evil. However, I would say that it's also longstanding in history. So that kind of thing. A third offense is mandatory, you know, capital punishment or life in prison. That's not exactly a new idea.
Yeah, but I think what would be interesting, and I'm sure, of course, the juries aren't being told this, but do juries have an impact on sentencing? Can they say that we disagree with the mandatory sentence, or do they have to nullify the whole thing if the sentence is too great? What can juries do about sentences?
That is another huge area of concern.
Okay.
By and large, the jurors are totally in the dark about sentencing implications, and it's deliberately that way. They are kept in the dark because the judges don't want them to know, and the prosecutors don't want them to know the sentencing implications of what they're doing.
Wow.
And in fact, they are instructed at most levels. You are not even to think about the potential sentences. They are actually told that they're not even supposed to look it up, not supposed to think about it. And you see a lot of abuses of this because sometimes jurors think that they're slapping someone on the wrist and giving him, you know, probation or 6 months in jail. They later find out that the judge then took their verdict and sentenced the defendant to 40 years in prison.
That could have changed the whole verdict had they known that ahead of time.
Absolutely.
Oh, this is getting worse than I thought. I got a quote here from the Constitution Society, which I don't know if you know about them, but they do a lot, it looks like a lot of parallel writing to what I found on the FIJA site. And it says, why did our founding fathers expect citizen juries to judge our laws as well as the guilt of the individual? And the answer is, if a juror accepts as the law that which the judge states, then that juror has accepted the exercise of absolute authority of a government employee and has surrendered a power and right that once was the citizen's safeguard of liberty. And that's a quote from 1788.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, when you think about it, why did the founding fathers work so hard to get the right to trial by jury in the Constitution?
Good question.
They didn't do that because they thought the jury was just a fact-finding mechanism. That isn't why they did that. They did it because they intended fully that the jurors would be one of the most important, I would say the most important, I can't think of one more important, frankly, check on the power of government. And, you know, and it is, you know, the, in the Constitution, the right to jury trial is in there several times. It's in the pre-Bill of Rights, in Article 3 of the Constitution, even before the Bill of Rights was attached, there's a right to jury trial. Then in the Sixth Amendment, there's a right to jury trial. There's a Seventh Amendment right to jury trial in civil cases. And, of course, there's also a grand jury clause in the Fifth Amendment. So the Founding Fathers absolutely were intent on shackling the government, binding, you know, strapping down the government with the chains of juries. Juries were supposed to monitor and check and control government.
And it's been totally changed around. And this is, I want to go back to some of the, which cases you're familiar with that kind of brought this about in the founding days and then how it changed. I want to give you my my mandatory jury instruction and see what you think of this. So jury, my law, when I get this into a bill, it says the juries before deliberating will receive a Miranda-type mandated instruction from all judges. And that instruction is you have the right to judge the laws as well as the facts of the case. And if you find the laws unjust or unconstitutional, you have the right, power, and duty to nullify the laws and can acquit or find not guilty on that basis alone. What if they got that instruction?
I like that. Yeah. Well, I like that language. You know, we're always quibbling. It's funny. I've worked on similar kind of, you know, actually writing bills is not as easy as a lot of people think. You have to get your language very precise.
Mm-hmm.
The Founding Fathers, of course, struggled. You know, Madison struggled with you know, Adams and you know, they all struggled against each other with regard to the precise wording of these things.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually very much like it. Like I said, there needs to be one of those clauses, the remedy clause, saying that if it doesn't happen, if the judge fails to fully inform and instruct the jury, it's a done deal, a mistrial and reversible error on appeal.
Let me add that to my my clause that I have there, if judge fails to instruct.
Let me just tell you, there are actually four states whose constitutions, state constitutions,
got them right here,
actually do have provisions for fully informed juries. They actually say in their state constitutions that juries are to be judges of both the law and the fact. What are those states?
Oh, no, I've got them right here. I've got the quotes. I'm way ahead of you.
Okay,
I do my homework, okay? So I've got the four states right here. I've got the exact language. I want to go over that after we take another break, and Pete wants to talk to you as well. So we're going to do that in just a little bit. It's 8:35 now, and I have my special guest, Dr. Roger Roots, legal advisor to the Fully Informed Jury Association. We will be right back. As we were talking about fully informed juries and jurors and all that, it's been our legal theme here. Anyway, all right, let's bring back Dr. Roots. How you doing, sir? There we are. Are you there?
I'm here.
Okay, good. Just want to make sure. Okay, there we go. Yeah. I think we left you off hold for a bit. You're sort of listening to me chatting with my producer, but I'm really happy with this show. I've been wanting to do this for a long time. You've got my article on the Miranda instruction for jurors, and that's where that language is. And I want to add that clause that you recommended on if the judge fails to instruct, that goes to a mistrial. And I think that would be fascinating to put that in. And I don't know if you can bring that before the FIJA board. You're saying that you don't think they'd go for a federal or state-mandated jury instructions like that law that I'm proposing?
Well, now, the FIJA board, let me just say, FIJA is a nonprofit educational organization.
Okay.
So it cannot, you know, it's a little bit bound. It can't be political lobby.
Oh, okay.
All right. So we educate. We don't politically lobby.
Well, that's my job, then.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. And, of course, I think FIJA, you know, we all would support, you know, efforts along these lines, of course. We're an educational organization.
Okay. Well, in that case, I'm going to ask you at some point how you fully inform jurors. We're going to get into that in a little bit. But I got Pete wants to talk to you right now, so let's bring Pete up. Pete, go ahead. What you got?
Hey, Dr. Roger. How are you guys doing?
I'm doing fine.
Hey, I have a couple of little questions and comments. One, I have a problem with jurors, and I'm not an anarchist or anything. I was involved in a jury one time, and the cat was being charged with two life sentences, and we weren't told. And that would have made a big difference. Another one, there was a victim that filed four different lawsuits about sexual harassment against her bosses and three of them were settled out of court for cash settlements, and the fourth one, it was my cousin, and he said not know but double hockey sticks know. I'm not pleading no, you know, contest anything. I did not do it. Took him to court. Cost him thousands. And the second the court case was over, his attorney said, by the way, this lady's filed four different charges, this very same thing, and if they don't settle out of court, they take you to court. And the jurors weren't notified about that, you know?
Well, good question. Hold on with that, Pete. Let's find out. How much do you think jurors should be informed about previous cases, out-of-court settlements, things like that, Dr. Ritz?
You know, that's a tricky question because, you know, I'm sort of pro-defendant. I'm pro-criminal defense, not prosecution.
Okay.
And so, you know, it is one of those things that comes up a lot. Many defendants have prior records. And it's unfortunate that if a guy is on trial, let's say for, a gun charge.
Okay.
And you know, if he has prior history as a, you know, if the jury is fully aware that this guy is an absolute scumbag, you know, he's been arrested a dozen times for spousal abuse, heroin, he's a junkie,
right.
You know, and if the jury, you know, so it is, unfortunately, you know, people will tend to size a guy up based on his prior record, and that's unfair to the
right.
guy.
Okay.
The guy, you know, so there is a right that the jury just consider, did you commit the shoplifting charge that you're currently on trial for?
Okay.
Not the stuff, you know, 5 years ago, the rape thing that you were accused of. You know, if they knew of that.
No, that makes
sense. You know, and so it's a tricky question.
Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. How do you fully inform jurors? How does FIJA work?
Well, it's, you know, it's outreach in any way, in all directions. Obviously, FIJA generates brochures, pamphlets, and flyers and things. People everywhere, sometimes at courthouses or around courthouses, will pass out flyers and things. Sometimes they run into trouble where the prosecution doesn't like it and will falsely accuse them of jury tampering.
Oh, okay.
Then we'll use jury tampering charges. Of course, the crime of jury tampering is an ancient recognized crime,
mm-hmm.
and it's, you know, true jury tampering is when you go up to a juror and you either pay the juror, you bribe the juror, or you threaten the juror and say, if you don't come down on the case in the way I want, I'm going to take your kneecaps off or something. That's true jury tampering.
Yeah.
All right. But you'll see around the country there have been a few cases where there are some guys out near the courthouse, maybe in front of the courthouse, handing out flyers, just fully informing the jurors as they come in. And they get accused of jury tampering just for fully informing the potential jurors of their rights and the great history of trial by jury.
This should be in every education system in the basic civics classes of the right of jurors and the power of jurors over the government, but it's not.
It really should be in every, absolutely. There should be much more education about this. Of course, the government does not like to support education along these lines.
They don't want fully informed citizens.
Right.
Yeah. Let's take Charles, who has a question for you. Charles, why don't you go
ahead. Good morning. Good show.
Thank you.
I have to ask the doctor, he mentioned that all this was possibly happening by accident, and he didn't use the word conspiracy. How does the government, when they charge people with a conspiracy to market cocaine or conspiracy to do this, that, or the other, What defines a conspiracy? In the law.
The federal prosecutors love to charge people with conspiring to break the law, and they cite these federal statutes to say if two or more people agree to break the law, then the government doesn't even have to prove that they broke the law. I mean, it's astounding. So,
I guess my question is then, why would not all this that's happening with the public school systems, with the with this jury, uninformed jury, why couldn't you call that a conspiracy? Somewhere down the line, some people changed it, and Roosevelt said years ago that anything that happens in politics does not happen by accident. It's planned that way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that gets back to the great question of where we went wrong. So, in juries and judges.
Well,
yeah.
maybe we need to look at it like this. Maybe we didn't go wrong. They didn't go wrong. They there's another old saying that the height of political intelligence is to have your acts of intent look like errors of stupidity.
That's right.
Ooh, good point.
Right.
I hadn't heard
so
that before.
So maybe this is all happening intentionally, not accidentally. Because if you take this quote and look at the evidence, I think the evidence would show that there are powerful people behind these so-called unintentional acts that would point to the fact that a conspiracy, by my definition, is when two or more people get together and plot evil in secrecy.
Yeah, it makes
and
sense.
Certainly,
it,
like
not...
now, Trump's being accused of a conspiracy with the Soviet Union, and I don't know why we have such a problem with conspiracy.
Well, like I said, I mean, it's collusion or mutual agreement or conspiracy. You know, it's almost easier to look at lawyers as just in, they have a self-interest. It is in their self-interest to promote that view of legal practice, that they have superior knowledge to the common layman. And it, so it's in their self-interest, and you can look at they don't need a conspiracy, frankly. When it's in their self-interest, all of them, to especially judges, you know, the particular subset of lawyers, it is in their self-interest to promote this theory of the law that they tell the jurors what the law is. The jurors are to be instructed that they can't even think about the law. It's in their self-interest. So I don't even think it needs a conspiracy, frankly, because each one of them acting individually will act in a way that gives the appearance of conspiracy.
Yeah, that's true. In other words, they're sort of they're collectively doing it together, talking about it, you know, at their dinners and lunches and things, and it just sort of filters through that this is how they maintain their power without actually saying this is how we're going to maintain our power. They just kind of do it. I want to bring up the Marbury v. Madison case, which is where I think a lot of our problems began when the judges, the Supreme Court took it upon themselves to start interpreting the Constitution rather than limiting. In a way, it's kind of sidelined into this power that if we can interpret the law, we can tell everybody else how to interpret the law. Do you see like a sort of a following, like a transfer of power from judicial review into judicial tyranny over the juries?
Oh, absolutely. The two are related.
Okay.
You know, the Constitution does not actually say that judges will have any kind of sole power to interpret the law above or beyond anybody else. And that's not even mentioned in the Constitution. There's no idea about that in the Constitution. But as you mentioned, Madison, Marbury versus Madison, a very early Supreme Court case, which sort of laid the groundwork for this idea that the judges, the Supreme Court, decides what the Constitution means. That was not the original intent of the Founding Fathers. The Founding Fathers, in fact, you can find some quotes that where they indicate that the Constitution is to be written in language that can be understood by anyone.
Yep.
And in practice, you know, the other branches have the right to independently interpret the Constitution the way they would do so. And the common man, the citizens of the United States, also have that right. But, you know, it certainly it goes along the same lines. There has been this long trend, a trend in the legal profession and the judiciary to sort of try to do everything they can to take the power of interpretation from all other sources, including the other two branches, by
yeah,
the way.
Yeah, exactly. And I got a couple of quotes here. It is not only the juror's right, but his duty to find the verdict according to his own best understanding, judgment, and conscience, though in direct opposition to the direction of the court. And that was John Adams in 1771. Another one here, it is usual for the jurors to decide the facts and to refer the law arising on it to the decision of the judges, but this division of the subject lies with their discretion only, and if the question relate to any point of public liberty, or if it be one of those in which the judges may be suspected of bias, the jury undertake to decide both law and fact, and that's Thomas Jefferson. So they agreed way back when, but I think, like I say, John Jay, the first Supreme Court justice, was also a person who was fully in favor of juries, jury nullification, and the jury's supremacy over the judge, but it wasn't until John Marshall, I think it was like the fourth Supreme Court justice, that held the Marbury versus Madison, and that's, I think, which once that went wrong, it was kind of like a cancer that spread through the entire judiciary, and that's what got us to our state today.
Yes, and it has definitely grown, that idea. The idea that the lawyers and especially judges have some special knowledge of the law.
Yeah.
That was not the original intent.
Yeah.
That idea has grown throughout American history.
Wow. We only got a little bit of time left. I have to take another break. We got a couple of callers on the line, and I want to get to just maybe one of the situations. Maryland, Indiana, Oregon, and Georgia specifically say that jurors are empowered to judge the law, and we'll get back to that in just a little bit. 8:51 here. We're going to take our last break with Dr. Roger Roots of the Fully Informed Jury Association. The mystery continues as to what you can do as a juror, sneaking into back courtrooms, deciding what you will. Who says we don't have fun here with these issues? Dr. Roots, welcome back. It's interesting, I was going over some of these constitutional provisions in the cases here, and some of them are good, some of them have exceptions. Maryland's says that in the trial of all criminal cases, the jury shall be the judges of the law, I like that language, as well as the fact, except that the court may pass upon the sufficiency of the evidence to sustain a conviction. So I always have these little disclaimers in there, what the juries can do. Indiana says, in all criminal cases whatsoever, the jury shall have the right to determine the law and the facts. That's probably the purest one.
Yeah.
Oregon says, in all criminal cases, whatever, the jury shall have the right to determine the law and the facts. Oh, here we go. Under the direction of the court as to the law and the right of a new trial, as in civil cases. So you see little disclaimers in there?
Yeah, and keep in mind what has happened even in those states, Indiana even with that powerful language, you wouldn't think there could be any quibbling with that language. However, the judges over time in Indiana even have gradually watered that down and said, well, okay. And then you find that when a guy gets convicted in violation of that, well, it's not overturned. That's why you need those overturn clause. You need the clause in there that says any failure to fully inform the jury shall result in reversal on appeal or something like that.
Okay, or mistrial, yeah.
Yeah, because over time, the judges will gradually take even those state constitutional provisions and water them down and say, well, they don't really mean what they say they mean.
Right.
They don't apply in every case, and there's a lot of little conditions. And, you know, in Georgia, I think the Georgia Constitution has a great jury rights provision in it.
Mm-hmm.
But the judges in Georgia, maybe even the Georgia Supreme Court has ruled, well, oh, yeah, they're the judge of the law and the facts, but only in cases where we decide, we the judges.
Oh, yeah, I've got the Georgia one right here. Yeah, it says the right to a trial by jury shall remain inviolate, except that the court shall render judgment without the verdict of a jury in all civil cases where no issuable defense is filed. Yeah, they have some other things, but, yeah, it's, ugh.
You could call it human nature of people who are on the bench.
Yeah.
It is in their self-interest. You know, it's in their self-interest to seek power and to seek greater authority and greater jurisdiction.
Yeah.
And so you see gradual movement where, oh, yeah, that's sure. That's a great principle in thought. It looks good on paper. But
yeah.
In this case, you know, I, the judge, will decide that, you know, the jury has no such authority.
Constitution's,
you know,
just a suggestion, yeah. I want to get to Marshall real quick here. And first of all, thank you for coming on the show. It's been fabulous to have you. We're going to have to get you back more on the Clive and Bundy thing. But I want to get Marshall in with his question. Marshall, go ahead.
Yeah, my question is, would you recommend the Bundy defendant, or if you found yourself a defendant, would you take the stand and inform the jury yourself?
Ooh, great question.
Well, let me think about that. I would say it depends on the case, but I'm a proponent of taking the stand. I think defendants, by and large, benefit themselves when they take the stand. Keep in mind they are subject to all kinds of problems and attacks, especially if they have background problems, which many defendants do. And when you take the stand and you try to inform the jury of this, by the way, I've actually seen this happen occasionally. The judges frequently react with overwhelming anger, punishment. They will try to warn or threaten the person. Sometimes it doesn't help, frankly, because error. And but that's not always the case. Many jurors are aware of their true powers, but to the extent that they're not aware, do they become aware just because the defendant says this, and then they hear the judge you know, overrule essentially the defendant. Yeah. You know, so I don't know the effect of it.
I have to interrupt you. We're out of time. It's been fabulous to have you on the air, sir. I'll send you my language with the update. That's great. Marshall, you hit it out of the park with your question, but I have to have you. And that's how it was. I know how, you know, how the podcasts were created. It's kind of funny, but that's how they ended. So when we were out of time, we literally were out of time. And so then, of course, you'd have the music and the other stuff and the top of the hour news break and all the other commercial stuff that happens on commercial radio. Pianki called actually during this this recorded interview from back in 2017. And so, Pianki, you want to call back? We'll have a few minutes. We'll get about 10 minutes before Dr. Pry calls in. We start talking national security and the treason of the Brandon insurrection, which he calls the Biden insurrection, the Biden administration. Why, I don't know. I mean, you have to actually legally be there before you can say that. So, Pianki, you want to call back? We'll talk about this before we get to Dr. Pry. Be right back. Greg Penglis here for my book, The Complete Guide to Flight Instruction. Everyone at some point in their life wants to learn how to fly. Few try. Even fewer go on to get a license. I believe a major reason for that is how we teach people how to fly. My book is designed to help you navigate the flight training system, but it's so much more than that. It really describes an entirely new way to teach flying. So if you've never tried a lesson or got discouraged in your training and quit for any reason, this book can help you. Don't be a rote pilot who just follows procedures. Be a thinking pilot who makes great decisions, who understands all the reasons why we do what we do. You can incorporate these principles into your own flight training at any time. The Complete Guide to Flight Instruction is featured on the Action Radio with Greg Penglis Facebook page and is available from Amazon.com. Action Radio, part of the ADHD Radio Network, the ultimate free speech zone. We the people give our consent to be governed through writing the laws by which we are governed and have the power through juries to nullify the laws by which we do not consent to be governed. At Action Radio, we don't report the news. We are the news. Every other show reports what has happened. We talk about what can happen. From the questions no one has thought to ask, to the answers no one has thought to consider, to the actions no one has dared to take. That is Action Radio. Yeah, baby. We're back. Hopefully not Friday, but July 13th, 2017. And so fairly early in my broadcast career, which only started 5 years ago, really. I'd done some part-time stuff in other places before that, but this is my first full-time job at WBY, and now I'm here at Blog Talk Radio. Pianki, you called during the middle of that interview, and I couldn't really tell you that it was a recording, but that's one of my favorites. And so I'm playing some of the classic interviews from WBY with, like, Gordon Chang and Grover Norquist, Dr. Walter Williams. Even some of the Matt Gaetz interviews we had. And it's really fun to sort of, you know, dig these up and see, you know, where we were then and where we are now. What did you think? Fully informed juries, Pianki.
Well, you know, that's a very tedious issue there.
Mm-hmm.
Because of juries, first, you know, if you don't have an educated populace, it would never work right. People are going to put their emotions into it. I mean, I can think of some cases with the Zimmerman. Mm-hmm. And with the Zimmerman trial, and what was the other kid's name that got killed? Martin. Then you got the George Floyd. I do believe that an individual's character should be brought forth so the mm-hmm. jury would know who that individual is, because past actions has a propensatory effect on how they act today. But
I see it as evidence. To me, it's just evidence. If the evidence of a crime, you know, is the fact that you've committed the same crime six times, I would take that in consideration. That seems to make sense. Why you can't bring that in? You may not be able to bring in completely different issues, you know, if you're in a trial, because you really have to limit it to the crimes. In other words, if you're a tax cheat and you're being brought in for, you know, robbing a bank, you know, would you have to bring up the tax charges? Would you have to bring up a DUI, for example, on an embezzlement case? You know, in other words, would you want to limit it to relevant past crimes? If someone's a domestic abuser, you know, and they've been married 5 times, that might be relevant, I would think. But different crimes wouldn't
be. Well, yeah, it has a lot to do with the character. For instance, mm-hmm. you got people in traffic stops.
mm-hmm.
A police officer may stop you for an illegal left turn. But
right.
in doing so, inspection of your car, you see that you got bad tires, you got windshield wipers. Well, you got citizens that don't think that they should pull to take those into account. Then you got citizens that's speeding, and they mm-hmm. say, well, the speed limit is 55, but I was in a hurry to get to a job interview. So that's the speed limit should be nullified. So you've got the people
that's wishful thinking.
That you're going to – then how are you going to have to screen all these people, and then they're going to say that it's illegal what you're doing. And you got blacks who think that the police department, and I've heard this. Matter of fact, I've heard them say that Bundy should be locked up
mm-hmm.
because they think that he's violating the law by being on federal land. And then we talk about all the time that the federal government really don't have any right to own land like
it's not
they do
land.
Today.
Yeah, it's interesting that Dr. Roots was the same person I talked to about that 5 years later. Well, I've been in contact with him a little bit. I told him I was playing the recording of the interview today, and so he'll pick it up probably live or a podcast, you know, at some point. But I'm going to put together our judicial bills, and I have one that gets rid of judicial review because the Constitution never granted the power for the Supreme Court or any judge, for that matter, to, quote, interpret the Constitution. That's something they usurped for themselves, and government agencies and departments do not have the right to grant themselves power. The whole purpose of a constitution, so they don't do that, you know. And then I had bills on we've got one on the judicial review with the mandatory jury instruction that I talked about. You know, you have the right to judge the law as well as the facts in the case, and if you find the law unjust or unconstitutional, you have the right to acquit on that basis alone. You know, so in other words, it doesn't matter.
Well,
so in other words, the evidence of a crime, the crime itself may be the crime. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, then you got cases where an individual uh-huh. who gets shot by a police officer. But the mm-hmm. things that led up to him being stopped is never taken in consideration. Driving without a driver's license, making illegal turns. You got a warrant out
for you. Car smells of marijuana or other things.
Yeah, car smells of marijuana. Just like this last case with this guy from the Congo.
Uh-huh.
He shouldn't. And how do they let people into the country that can't even speak English?
Well, to create a peasant class, J.D. Vance is quoted as saying something
just
like
that illegal.
On the news. Yeah. Well, that is illegal. The government is breaking the law.
They are creating an invasion.
It's
illegal in the country. Here you got a person from the Congo. He stopped in an area where there's a lot of car thefts going on. His license plate does not match the vehicle. Then when the opportunity arrives, he struggles with the police. And the police are not supposed to shoot them. That's what people on the street think. People on the street think that police should shoot you in the finger rather than shoot you in center mass. So you're dealing with a very, very precarious public, and then you want to give them the right to say that a law is not lawful. You got a problem.
Well, yeah. You know, you got a problem with juries anyway and people being uninformed. I think there's a government conspiracy. The whole education system is designed to dumb people down so that all arguments become emotional, that people can't analyze. They can't use logic. They can't use reason, the things that we use on the show all the time. And as I said to Dr. Ruth, I don't read things that other people write about the Constitution. I don't have to. It doesn't mean I'm a brilliant constitutional scholar, you know, but I can read and I can use logic and reason, and anybody can. And if you assume that that most people should at least have a basis in logic and reason before graduating high school, then you'd be able to take that and use that throughout every skill, from jury to job to raising kids to starting a business.
Maybe.
No, I don't think so. No, I would never have professional jurors. Absolutely not. They'll be just as corrupt as professional judges. They will not be accountable to the people. They'll be government employees. So why would you want government employees as a check on other government employees?
Well, if you got a case in Colorado, can you pull jurors out of New York?
Good question. I would say no, unless
you're
going to fund them.
Mississippi?
Well, no, they change the venue. They don't change where the jurors are located. But the jurors can still be fully informed.
Yeah,
here's what you should do.
When you change the venue for a person that committed a crime, just like right now in Washington, in Utah, where the Utah Jazz is giving these scholarships for only white, I mean, only non-white students. Other words, white students can't apply.
Right.
Yeah, but if you put a jury on the stand to judge that ruling, they would say it's okay.
Yeah, if you got a black juror, if you got a black jury, they might say, you know, sort of have the get whitey attitude. Yeah, that's a problem. I mean, that is a huge problem. But then you have some kind of juror misconduct or challenge or something like that. I'm not sure how you would work that. But that's why the OJ case was so dangerous to jury nullification, because they nullified on the basis of they really liked OJ. They didn't want him to be guilty, or they didn't want a black guy to be convicted, you know, by the white establishment. So that was a decision of prejudice. It wasn't a decision on the merits of the actual charges, because the charges and the evidence, although poorly presented, the problem is the prosecution did a lousy job. But the problem is that people, when they think of jury nullification, they go immediately to OJ. And the problem with that is, you know, the real jury nullification is when a jury, like California, where you have to apply to get a permit to carry a gun. And if you live in not the best area and you decide to carry a gun anyway, you can be arrested and you're involved like a self-defense situation. They won't charge you. The self-defense could have been legal, but they'll charge you for illegally possessing a gun. And you say, well, it's my Second Amendment right. Well, say, well, we have a law against that. You have to get a permit, and the sheriff didn't give you a permit. All right. So then the jury can say, well, that permit law is unconstitutional. So the fact that they may have broken the law itself is the crime. Therefore, we nullify, we acquit, because the Second Amendment says that they have a right to keep and bear arms. And that's the best use, not necessarily gun cases, but the best use of jury nullification is where they, and I don't even like the term nullification. I would say, I don't know, jury, you know, result or jury finding or whatever the jury conclusion. Is that the law itself is the problem. That law should not exist. Therefore, you can't be convicted of breaking a law that should not exist, because it violates the Constitution. So that's the best use of how juries should be using their power. But they're not informed of that. They're not told. And I got Dr. Fry on the line, so I'll get to him in just a second. But go ahead, Bianchi.
Yeah, let's get Dr. Fry, because I could go on with this for a while.
No, we can't. Well, we got time tomorrow. We got time the next day. I mean, this is ongoing. And then, of course, my other whole theory that, COVID – you know, channeled us into this home work hybrid environment. And I'm wondering how much of it is intentional, how much is going to be tried to maintain afterwards in the depopulation of the cities. We'll get into net zero carbon and other things as we go. But let me get Dr. Price's theme up here. And let's talk about the latest treason coming out of the Brandon insurrection. And where to hide them? Oh, wait a minute. I'm not, it's Monday. I'm not quite organized yet. I'll get better as the week goes on. At least I hope so. All right. Be right back. What is national security? How much is enough? What about the cost? What are our adversaries doing? Who wins between the State Department and the Pentagon? How accurate is our intelligence capability? Are we keeping up with our nuclear deterrent? Do we have better weapons than our adversaries? How would we know? Can we withstand an EMP attack? How is our missile defense? How about the basic power grid? Is it safe? These are the questions Dr. Pry has been dealing with his whole career. Dr. Peter Vincent Pry is the Executive Director of the Task Force on National and Homeland Security. He has served on the Congressional EMP Commission, the Congressional Strategic Posture Commission, the House Armed Services Committee, and the CIA. He is the author of The Power and the Light, the Congressional EMP Commission's War to Save America. And now he anchors the National Security Report here on Action Radio. How much national security is enough? And now, Dr. Peter Vincent Pry.
Yeah, someday I'll have a producer again. I won't have to push my own buttons. That'll be nice. I'll have all kinds of great tunes and bumpers and all this stuff. Yeah. Good morning, sir. How are you today?
Oh, well, thank you for having me as always, Greg. A little hungover from my Easter celebrations.
Oh, my goodness. What did you do?
Just overeating mostly, you know.
Oh, okay.
But, you know, the bad news, I'm always the purveyor of bad news on your show.
Yeah, but we have to hear it.
This latest
We have to know this stuff.
We've talked Now, we've talked in the past about this thing called the Nuclear Posture Review, which has, in the course of the many years, the many decades that we've had nuclear weapons to defend this country, there's only been, you know, maybe 5 or 6 nuclear posture reviews. So they're really important. And they are usually done by the Department of Defense in consultation with the State Department and the White House to evaluate what are the nuclear threats in the world, how many nuclear weapons do we need, what kind of nuclear strategies we should be following. So it's basically a review of our nuclear weapon systems and our nuclear weapons strategy and how that meshes with our political and foreign policy goals. And so, you know, answering one of the fundamental questions you ask, how much is enough? And interestingly, President Trump, had a nuclear posture review. And now Biden is doing his own nuclear posture review.
This is huge. I'm curious why they specifically did that. Is that to yet reverse more of what Trump did? That the woke people, the Millie who, you know, wants to. I'm going to ask you if Millie gave our posture review to his part in China. But why would they do that so quickly? Unless they were trying to reverse
everything
Trump did that was right.
Obviously, because they do want to reverse course on what President Trump was planning, and we're going to talk about some of the specifics that are coming out today, because the Biden nuclear posture review is not yet publicly available; it's still classified. They've shared a classified version with Congress, and some of what we've seen come out of it is a little bad news. But let me talk about President Trump. I wasn't planning to talk about that, but if it's okay.
Spontaneity is what makes this show interesting. Yeah, feel free. Go for it.
Yeah, one of the things that's interesting, because this will give you an idea of just how far left, you know, the Democrats want to go with the nuclear posture review. You know, when Trump came in, he authorized a nuclear posture review that had been, you know, many years since we'd had one. I can't remember when the last one was. I think it was back in the Reagan administration. Mm-hmm. And President Trump reportedly was just shocked to discover that the United States did not have nuclear superiority over the Russians. You know, he thought that we would have a huge preponderance. And in fact, he was shocked to find out that it was the Russians who actually had significant advantages over us in all categories, in tactical nuclear weapons and the rest. And Trump, during his first meeting with the Pentagon over this, you know, demanded to know how did this happen. And he wanted to launch a reportedly, I haven't had this independently verified, but it was much reported in the press. And it's probably true, because it sounds like
a
common sense reaction
that
President Trump and any American would have, to being given this bad news about why did we let the Russians not only catch up with us but surpass us in the number of nuclear weapons and technology. And he was demanding that we should move toward getting a tenfold advantage over them. And this was all reported from the New York Times and the Washington Post, criticizing the president as displaying his ignorance because he didn't understand arms control and why it made sense that why our current strategic posture made sense. And what Trump and it also demonstrates, I think, what a moderate and reasonable president we had, because, you know, the president, unfortunately, because I think his instincts were absolutely spot on, but he was talked out by his military advisors and by the State Department. He was talked back and on that. And President Trump did launch a modernization program. It wasn't the one he initially had wanted, but in effect, it was the Obama administration's promised modernization program for our triad, because President Obama had promised the Senate that if they signed the New START treaty, that's the treaty that further reduced the nuclear weapons allegedly on both sides, on Russia and the United States, bringing it down by another 1,000 weapons or something to 1,550 to the sides. The Senate was very reluctant to sign on to the New START treaty because it was the least verifiable treaty we had ever signed. And they were very nervous with going down to lower and lower numbers. This looked like it was just Obama's reckless dream of achieving a world without nuclear weapons at the U.S. expense, with the U.S. leading the way. But Obama said, look, sign the treaty, sign on to New START, and we'll give you this modernization program, all three legs of the triad. We'll start building new submarines, new ICBMs, and new bombers. And he broke his promise. Obama got the New START treaty, pocketed it, and then he broke his promise and didn't fund the promised modernization program. And so the Trump modernization program is really the Obama administration's modernist program, which was much more modest than what President Trump's instincts wanted. So basically, the Biden administration comes in, and they don't like even the Obama administration modernization program. They think that is too aggressive, and they're kind of blaming it on Trump. And one of the things we have learned, because we don't, as I said, the Biden administration nuclear posture review is classified, and yes, it's intended to depart and be a radical departure from Trump's direction on modernization, which was not really Trump's; it was Obama's direction on modernization. Okay. But we now know a couple of things that have leaked out, and we can trust that they are true because they're also verified by changes in the defense budget. And that is the cancellation of two very critical nuclear weapon systems. And this isn't the only thing. This is just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, as we go on, we're going to see more and more damage being done to our nuclear deterrent. But this is a sample. The first two things we found, and please feel free to jump in with comments or because I don't want to, orange crate here.
No, you're doing fine. The first question I have is, let me just say this before you get started. Are you going to have access? Will you be able to read the classified version?
Not currently. I don't have a, I've got clearances, but you've got to have a specific, I'm not attached to a member of Congress or to a defense contractor or to a part of the Pentagon that would give me a reason to be able to read that classified nuclear posture review.
Too bad. I don't want to report it because it's classified, but I'd just be curious if. Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, but anybody can figure out where it's going because it's a really badly kept secret. I mean, basically, if you just are a regular reader of the propaganda coming from the anti-nuclear activists, the Union of Concerned Scientists, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, these people are Biden administration's nuclear kitchen cabinet, and Biden's nuclear posture review is going to probably give these guys their wish list. This became obvious last year when Biden. All precedent the Carnegie Foundation. There's an anti-nuclear group that's funded by the Carnegie Foundation. They're connected with Plowshares, and they want us to get rid of our ICBMs. They want to unilaterally ban U.S. ICBMs. The White House, President Biden, made the Pentagon fund a special study to make that case for why the U.S. should give up its ICBMs, and so the Pentagon, which has fiercely resisted that, was forced to pay money for a study that went directly to the Secretary of Defense, so that the anti-nuclear point of view would be heard. And that's one of the most extreme examples of the kinds of things they want to do. And it's a real bad sign that a president of the United States would actually force his Pentagon to pay for a study that they don't want and that they disagree with and force the Secretary of Defense to take a briefing and have to read that study. You know, as you know, Secretaries of Defense have a hard time saying no to their presidents. So that was all in the open.
That's
so
the problem.
Clearly.
Yeah.
So there's enough out there in the public, these anti-nuclear activists, the Biden administration, NPR, is probably going to try to give them their wish list. And, that includes banning ICBMs, banning strategic bombers so we don't have any nuclear-armed bombers anymore, and maybe cutting the ballistic missile submarine in half so that the United States only has a few hundred nuclear weapons, as minimum deterrence, and that we would do that unilaterally. That's their announced goal. And what we do know that has leaked out so far is bad enough, but that's and symptomatic, I think, of maybe that's where we're heading, and to talk about the two specific programs that have in effect been banned by President Biden now on the advice of his classified NPR are two systems, the sea-launched cruise missile, the nuclear mm-hmm. version of the sea-launched cruise missile, and the which is essentially a tactical nuclear weapon, and so you might consider it at the lower end of the deterrent spectrum. Because the Slicum N, as it's called, carries a nuclear, it would be armed with the old warhead that used to be carried by the Tomahawk, the W-80. And this thing has a selectable yield that can go as low as 5 kilotons. So it could be used for battlefield tactical purposes, which is what it's chiefly intended. And it would be fired from things like attack submarines and guided missile cruisers and destroyers and things like that. Could be used for strategic purposes too, though, because it's got an option where it can go up to 150 kilotons. But chiefly it's envisioned as a replacement for the Tomahawk. You know, Obama basically eliminated all the Tomahawk missiles. One doesn't have to be a strategic expert if one just lived through the Reagan and Clinton years, the Tomahawk was sort of the workhorse.
Bosnia.
It could write Libya, Afghanistan. Whenever a president wanted to make a symbolic gesture against terrorists or whatever, would launch a bunch of Tomahawks, destroy their attacks, because the Tomahawk also had a non-nuclear warhead, high explosive warhead. And that's how it was chiefly used, the high explosive warheads to go in and attack Al-Qaeda or attack, baby food factories in Libya that they thought were chemical and biological warhead facilities and maybe were, and that sort of thing. But the Tomahawk is like one of the most famous of our strategic systems.
Well, people saw
because
it. It's a very visible weapon system, and for I just want to jump in for a second on what a cruise missile is as opposed
yes,
to a
please.
Ballistic missile. Oh, thank you. A cruise missile is a fairly low speed, maybe 600 subsonic missile. It's not that big. It carries a particular warhead. I didn't know they had up to 150 kilotons. That's somewhere you can tell me if that's around Hiroshima strength. But 5 kilotons is not that big a weapon, as nuclear weapons go. And these things are very evasive. They usually fly below the radar. That's the beauty of them. They're hard to knock down. They're extremely accurate. They've got a built-in GPS system. They have a little map there. But I think once they're launched, at least the older ones, the Tomahawks, I don't know if they were able to be recalled, diverted, or exploded before they get there, or somehow disabled if they change their mind. I think once they're gone, they're gone. But you can tell me on that too. So that was one of the problems. But as the workhorse, yeah. And the other beauty of that was that you could attack an enemy and you weren't putting U.S. service people at risk. And so that was a huge advantage too, because you're not sending in airplanes, with pilots or bombers with pilots or fighters, bombers or anything else or ships that would get too close. They could launch these things from a distance, and they had pretty big range, if I remember. Cruise missiles had a fairly extensive range, so it was a safe weapon in terms of the people using it, but it's pretty devastating for the people on the other end. How'd I do?
Yes,
about right?
That's right. And
okay, good.
That's right. It could reach out about 1,500 miles, and which is a nice range.
Yeah.
And it had extreme accuracy, it could strike within feet of a target because of its terrain. It was called the TERCOM system, you know, a terrain matching system. It could actually see the ground, had a map in it and a computerized, and would show where this thing could go. I mean, it was boasted that a Tomahawk could fly into somebody's bedroom window, and that's not far from the truth.
Wow.
And that extreme accuracy is what made it very effective, so you could use high explosive warheads and know that you were going to, you know, get the other achieve your damage goals. And in the nuclear realm, you know, that very low yield could enable you to take out a bridge or participate as a tactical nuclear weapon on the battlefield, on both land battles and sea battles. The 150 kilotons is about 15 times more powerful than the Hiroshima bomb.
Oh, wow.
But that would enable you to do things like bunker busting, you know.
Right.
Wouldn't be able to get the deep, really deep underground bunkers that we've often talked about, which there are, you know, hundreds of these things in Russia and China and North Korea.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a lot more shallowly buried bunkers that, you know, would require a yield like that to take out. Or missile silo, hardened missile silo, for example, or hardened garage for mobile ICBMs and things of that sort. You know, so it was a very flexible, and basically Obama gave them all up.
Why?
Banned
were they
all obsolete?
The Tomahawks. Was there something wrong with them?
Well, they were old. That was the excuse. That's always the excuse, that they've reached the end of their service life, and that was true. You know, that they were really old. You know, but the logical thing would be, because this thing was so useful, to have a replacement, right?
Tomahawk
Obama
2.
Didn't authorize any replacement. He just gave them all up. And and so that's one of the things that President Trump got his way on. And the Navy, and it wasn't just President Trump who wanted it. The Navy said, well, we wanted this. We need this. And for obvious reasons. And so there was planned a replacement Tomahawk. That would have both conventional high explosive and nuclear capabilities again, and since there's basically been a ban on building new nuclear weapons, it would have used the W-80 warhead, which has this 5 kiloton, 150 kiloton combination for that. And the Navy wanted this. This wasn't some thing that President Trump imposed on the Pentagon. This was on their wish list. And Biden's own Pentagon, his own people, you know, are protesting the cancellation of the SLCM in, which has been defunded in the defense budget, so it's gone. And the rationalizations for this coming from the anti-nuclear side is, and which is not just being published in things like the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, but is the arguments that are being used by senior Democrats like Adam Smith, the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, as to why America doesn't need the SLCM in, is that, in fact, they portray it as a positively evil system, you know, because its low yield will encourage the Pentagon to engage in nuclear war fighting in a crisis, and therefore is supposedly a very destabilizing weapon, and we don't want one. We don't want a nuclear war fighting weapon in our inventory. But the record, I mean, you know, the Tomahawk, which came on board during the Reagan years as a nuclear arms SLCM, you know, helped win the Cold War. It wasn't destabilizing during the Cold War with the Soviet Union. It helped, was one of the factors that contributed to the victory in the Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
And was stabilizing. So the historical record doesn't support these claims. So that's one of the big sacrifices. And when you think of the utility of this thing, you know, it also enables us, for example, to have a nuclear deterrent anywhere in the world in hot spots, you know, like against North Korea, you know, or against Iran, without us having to deploy tactical nuclear weapons into the territory of our allies. You know, you can send an attack submarine or a guided missile cruiser and have it there, and the bad guys will know it's there, and that will hearten our allies and discourage our adversaries from aggression. So this is a real flexible, really useful thing, and everybody in the world seems to understand that, except the Biden administration and his anti-nuclear activist advisors. And it's just a real setback for American nuclear deterrence, especially when you consider, as we have often talked about on this show, that Russia has got at least a 10-to-1 advantage over us in tactical nuclear weapons. You know, we've only got these 100. In fact, the estimate is actually, I've been saying 180, but other people are saying it's 100, that we've only got 100 of these obsolete gravity bombs, you know, stored away in NATO Europe. You know, they're gravity bombs. So that means you have to penetrate adversary air defenses, which are increasingly difficult to do.
Mm-hmm.
And
they're unguided too, right? If they're gravity, they're just falling.
Unguided, right.
Just like
That's right.
Okay.
You know, can you get through the Russian air defenses to deliver these things? Probably not. And would since they're stored on the territories of countries that are, you know, Germany, France, the Benelux countries, you know, significant question. You have to inform those governments that, you know, we're going to take them out of their storage concerns and use them. Would the French let us do that? Well, they're not on French territory. I'm sorry about that. But the Benelux countries and Germany, Italy, you know, with the Italians, the Germans go along with that. You know, so it's not like we have control over them. We have the shared control with NATO, and they might rather surrender than let us use our own tactical nuclear weapons. So so that's a serious problem. You know, and the Slicka Man would have given us the flexibility so that we could use the weapon when and where we needed it. But it's gone under.
Yes. How much better was the Slicka Man than the submarine launch cruise missile than the Tomahawks they'd be replacing? What did we lose?
Well, we lost all of that because all of those were basically the Tomahawk. You know, the Tomahawk was launched from submarines. It was launched from bombers. And that delivery system is what Obama said, and he was right. I mean, by the time the Obama administration came along, this was way past its design life. But I don't think that was the chief reason why Obama banned it. I mean, I think that gave him an excuse for abolishing the Tomahawks and retiring those warheads, you know, into the stockpile so they're no longer used. But the real story here, there might be another dimension to this story, which is what I've been trying to bring out in this article of mine, you know, is that maybe the problem is not just with the replacement for the Tomahawk, which doesn't exist yet. I mean, the Navy was supposed to be developing a replacement for the Tomahawk. President Trump was authorizing that. But the warhead, the W-80, which is old than the Tomahawk itself. I mean, the thing was designed in the mid-70s. It was deployed in the early 80s. Things decades old. It was never designed to be that old. And on this show, we've talked before about this so-called science-based stockpile stewardship program that doesn't allow us to test our nuclear weapons. We haven't tested a nuclear weapon in 30 years. We basically depend on hocus pocus to reassure ourselves that these nuclear weapons still work. You know, the people who investigate the weapons never designed them. They've never designed a nuclear weapon. They've never tested a nuclear weapon. You know, you've got these kids, you know, computer whizzes using their computer models and looking at the components of the weapon. They're really not the same weapon that was deployed back in the Reagan years because parts do wear out even when they're just sitting there. And so they replaced a lot of parts, and they hope that putting in different parts that were not part of the original design, they hope that they will work, but they haven't tested them to ensure that they will. Perhaps another reason why the Biden administration is canceling the Slicka Man, you know, is because they don't want to admit that the W-80 warhead doesn't work anymore, that the labs can't certify it and have confidence that the thing is going to work anymore. That'd be a catastrophe for the anti-nuclear left, you know, because our whole basis for not testing for 30 years has been this promise, oh, don't worry, we can do it through so-called science-based stockpile stewardship using computers and engineering judgment, you know, by these inexperienced people at the labs. And it's really not. It's an oxymoron to call it science-based. Because real science involves testing. Real science is based on empirical facts, you know, that prove it, that the thing can actually work. So it's actually more like it should be called faith-based. It really should be called faith-based.
That's a good term for it, or guess.
Because
you know,
that's
it's
what
the
it
model.
Is. It's, yeah. Right. Now, the other weapon.
Well, before you get to the other weapon, I just want to jump in for a second. Yeah, because the whole idea is modeling. What they're doing is they're using computer models. Well, the models are based on the criteria that they create for the model. So if they create criteria that shows these things are still going to work, the model will show they're still going to work. But you look at models for COVID, you look at models for climate change, which are total disasters. You look at models for anything for predicting international events, and they're always wrong, or pretty much. You know, the idea of basing our national security on a model where someone puts in the criteria without being able to test is crazy, because in testing takes into account all variables, including the ones that aren't accounted for. That's why you test. Nobody drives a car that's never been test driven. Nobody flies on an airplane that's never been test flown. You can have the best computer models in the world, and things still happen during the test. That's why we test. So the fact that they're not testing right now is alone is enough to prove to me that these things, I would assume, they're not going to work, because they can't possibly take into account all the variables, and the variables are only accounted for in testing.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
That's why it's an oxymoron to call it, you know, science-based. It's just the opposite of science.
Yes, wishful thinking.
Don't engage in empiricism and testing to verify the truth, to verify the facts. You know, it's really faith-based. It's nuclear stockpile stewardship, you know.
Can you imagine announcing that? And now the faith-based nuclear deterrent system of the
insurrection.
I know, that
doesn't sound as good, though, as science-based, you know.
Yeah.
And they've been allowed to get away with that. It's just another example of how the Republicans just miss opportunities and don't think about these things. You know?
Well,
they never
should
have let the Democrats get away with calling this science-based stockpile stewardship.
Well, that's why I call them the GOP, the gelding old party. There's a reason for that that saying. That's what they are. You got geldings and Marxists. You know, anyway. Okay, cool. What's
the
second
weapon
system? Yeah, I want to hear about this one.
The other one that we now know is being given up. And mind you, this isn't everything we know. This is just the tip of the iceberg out of the nuclear posture review. So we're just starting to have this thing, the stuff leak out of the classified version. And none of it is good news. And these are two pieces of real bad news. The other one that's been canceled is the B-83, the nuclear bunker buster bomb. And
is it the MOAB?
The most powerful.
Is it the MOAB?
No,
the mother
MOAB
of all bombs?
Is a conventional. High-explosive weapon. This is our most powerful nuclear weapon in our inventory today, and the B-83. And so it's on the other end of the deterrent spectrum, whereas the Tomahawk is our the greatest tactical nuclear weapon we had, something that might help counterbalance the vast superiority the Russians have over us in tactical nuclear weapons, you know, so that you could have a very low yield that might be useful on the battlefield in a nuclear context. The B-83 is on the other end of the nuclear deterrent spectrum, which is it's our most powerful nuclear weapon. It's our only megaton class nuclear weapon remaining to us. It has a yield of 1.2 megatons, which is equivalent to 1.2 million tons of TNT. Divide 10 into 1.2 million, and that's how many times more powerful it is than the Hiroshima bomb. You know, it's over 100 times, I think 120 times more powerful than the Hiroshima bomb.
Wow.
And it's a really important weapon, because it's the only weapon we had that would give us something like a realistic chance of destroying the deep underground facilities that the Russians and Chinese and North Koreans' leadership have. You know, if you think about deterrence, what these guys care about most is their personal survival. You know, the best deterrent we would have is being able to plausibly threaten their lives, because they don't care about their people. That's second to their own survival and the survival of their elite buddies. And they can hide by the tens of thousands in these deep underground facilities. And the B-83 was not guaranteed, even the B-83 was not guaranteed that it could destroy these facilities. But it was the only one that that had a chance about being able to drive a shockwave, you know, with that kind of a yield down deep enough so that maybe, mm-hmm. you know, we could hold these guys at risk. It's the only one that could do it. And there was only one aircraft there. They were supposed to be delivered out of Whiteman Air Force Base, carried by the B-2, because it's a gravity bomb. And, you know, the B-2 is the only aircraft that can penetrate air defenses. It would have to fly low, close to supersonic speeds, and deliver this thing against the deep underground facility. And that one is canceled. And the reason for its cancellation, an anonymous senior Defense Department official, basically when people say, well, why are you giving up our most powerful nuclear weapon? You know, his explanation was, well, it's too expensive to maintain it. It's too expensive to keep maintaining this thing.
To make new ones.
and that brief, yeah, exactly. And that yeah. brief comment confirms my worst fears, what we've been talking about here. Oh, it's too expensive to maintain it. My translation of that is that the whiz kids at the labs can't patch this thing up one more time. It's just okay. too hard to do to maintain a safe, reliable nuclear deterrent with the B-83. That the thing has finally gone obsolete because the science-based stockpile stewardship program doesn't work. And they don't want to admit that. They don't want to admit that because it would admit that all of the nuclear weapons in our deterrent are questionable about whether they will work, because we've been doing the same thing, patching them up over and over again, extending them far beyond their original design lives, and having this faith-based stockpile stewardship program, hoping it'll work. But now I think we've got two weapons, at least, you know, the W-80 and the B-83, where even the whiz kids don't want these things in the arsenal anymore, because they can't patch them up well enough to have any confidence that they'll operate.
Well, it's a liability. What if they operate when they're not supposed to?
Well, exactly. Yeah. Because it's not just a question of them working against the adversary. They've also got to be safe. What if somebody accidentally drops one of these things, you know, when they're trying to load it onto a bomber? You know, they're supposed to be 1 point safe, and they were originally designed that way so that they would not explode under a whole range of scenarios. But that's also one of the things that's deteriorating. How safe and reliable are these things? So that and that deteriorates too over time as these things are patched up and repaired by people who never designed them and have never designed any nuclear weapon, but are just basically engaging in educated guesswork, you know, about what is necessary so the bigger issue here is how safe and secure and reliable mm-hmm. is the whole U.S. nuclear deterrent, you know, now that we're giving up on the Tomahawk successor, the W-80 warhead, and the B-83, you know, so at both ends of the nuclear deterrent spectrum, you know, we're giving up critical weapons. The Biden administration is banning critical weapons.
That's yeah, kill for no reason for this.
Right.
You know,
well, the reason is that they have no choice, because technologically these weapons are probably so bad now that, you know, that they can't keep them in the arsenal are facing up to the reality, but they don't want to admit that. You know, I think that's probably the real motive for doing it. I mean, and they're happy to do it because ideologically they're against nuclear weapons anyway. So anytime they have an excuse to get rid of a nuclear weapon, you know, they're glad to embrace that. And if the Biden administration thinks the way the Union of Concerned Scientists and other anti-nuclear groups like Plowshares think, and they do, they're not worried about giving up these capabilities, because they believe in minimum deterrence too. It's a sort of, call it a faith-based national security policy. You know, the Russians and Chinese don't believe what they're saying, and they're not preparing for fighting and winning a nuclear war despite what they say. They have to think just the way we do. Everybody knows that a nuclear war should never be fought and can't be won. And we have faith that that is true. And so we're gonna build down. We're going to use every opportunity to build down the U.S. nuclear deterrent to just a few hundred weapons, because this is all the weapons themselves are more dangerous than the Russians and the Chinese and the North Koreans.
Oh, I see.
And so,
that's fascinating.
That's how they think.
I got a couple of questions, but I want to see if Pianki has a question. He's on the line, too. Pianki, do you have a question for Dr. Pry about anything we've talked about today? Give me a chance to unmute.
No, I'm enjoying the conversation.
Okay. All right, cool. Well, feel free to jump in. My first question is, we're talking about the cost of maintaining these weapons. How much does it actually cost, especially since we already have the technology developed, so we don't have research and development. We just have the cost of production. We've got the uranium or plutonium. And ask about the, you know, whether that degrades over 30 years too, but just the cost of making a nuclear weapon. How expensive are these compared to maybe other systems, or do you know the cost for making one B-83 or maybe 10 or 20 of them, or however they measure this kind of stuff? How expensive are these things to make?
Well, I'm not sure I could break it out weapon by weapon for you, but during the height of the Cold War, when we were building, when we were matching the Soviet Union and had thousands of nuclear weapons. I think we had 15,000 nuclear weapons in our inventory. It was costing about 5%. The whole thing cost 5% of the defense budget, and that includes the support of the nuclear weapon labs and the defense industrial base that actually made the bombs and made the components and all of that. 5% of the defense budget, 95% of the defense budget was spent on other things. So it's nuclear weapons are really cost effective and very inexpensive, compared to what they do, which is the most important part of our defense, because these are the most advanced weapons technologically that exist at the present time, and they're the ones that our adversaries would rely on most of all for fighting a war or prevailing over us without war through nuclear blackmail. Now, to get back to where we were during the Cold War, though, is going to cost a lot of money if we can do it. And the Biden administration is not going to do it because they're so anti-nuclear. Because not only have we not tested nuclear weapons for 30 years, but because we have not been designing and building new nuclear weapons, all of that scientific and defense industrial base that used to exist has gone away. We can't even make triggers for nuclear weapons anymore, the plutonium and uranium triggers. In order to detonate a hydrogen bomb, a thermonuclear weapon, you have to set off a small atomic bomb or fission weapon, and that's what's called a trigger. These are usually made out of plutonium. We can't make them. Our plan is to be able to start making triggers again in the 2030s, more than a decade from now. And when the plan at least was to be able to make 30 triggers a year, just 30 a year, okay? Pakistan can make more triggers than that. And there was a recent report that was too optimistic, that our plan to make the triggers turned out to be erroneous, and that that they weren't going to be able to do it, that they need more time to be able to figure out how to do that. So we're really between a rock and a hard place when it comes to being able to resurrect our ability to make new nuclear weapons of new design, advanced technology weapons, let alone maintain the current inventory of nuclear weapons as they age out, because that's one of the most important things. That's one of the things that goes is those plutonium triggers. The plutonium has a relatively brief half-life. When they get to be 50 years old, they start deteriorating. And how much of that plutonium becoming inert, can you afford before the thing can't produce the temperatures and pressures necessary to trigger a thermonuclear explosion? We don't know because we don't test.
This is scary. You know, every product that we buy in the grocery stores has a best used by date. You know, these things have to have a date on them as well, where they're just not going to work anymore. So for the uranium, plutonium, and any other radioactive or degrading substances on board these things, over the past maybe 30, 40, 50 years, how much of that is still good? You know, does a uranium whatever, the explosive part of it that creates the reaction, I mean, how long does that actually last itself, just the uranium? I mean, doesn't that have to be changed periodically?
Well, the plutonium, the uranium, uranium-235
right.
Has a longer life than plutonium.
Okay.
Plutonium is the more worrisome thing, but there are other parts to nuclear weapons. There are pieces of plastic in them, okay, that play critical roles. There's metals like beryllium that play critical roles.
Hmm.
And these things experience accelerated aging, you know, because they're in the presence of highly radioactive materials like plutonium and uranium.
Oh, okay.
You know, so
that
these things
sense.
Are constantly being bombarded, you know, with radioactive effects which age them. And so these things have to be replaced even more often than the plutonium, cores. And, and there are electronic components likewise that break down. I think we might have talked about it on your show either last year or maybe the year before that, what was that part? There was an electronic part. God, getting so senile. There was a.
Well, that's going to talk about a lot of stuff. We've covered a lot of ground the last couple.
Yeah,
of years.
There was. I can't remember. Anyway, there's an electronic component that's really mm-hmm. important because what it does is it enables you the timing of sending the electric charge into the chemical explosives. Okay, the plutonium mm-hmm. trigger is surrounded by what's called
like
a chemical
primer.
Lens.
So
yeah,
like a primer
and
a rifle,
and it's basically okay. an implosion device. It's called the whole thing together is called an implosion device.
Okay,
and it's got these shaped charges that surround the plutonium core, that are designed to create an implosive shockwave. It's a spherical shockwave that collapses inward, and it's made by setting off these chemical charges that all surround the plutonium core, and they all have to go off exactly at the same time in order to optimize that spherical shockwave. Because if they don't go off at exactly the same time, then it's not a true spherical shockwave. You know, it's distorted. And the shape of the plutonium core as it collapses won't be a perfect sphere. And that, it might, you know, it still might generate what you need to get a thermonuclear explosion, but the more off it is, the less confident you can be that the trigger is going to do what it's supposed to do so that the bomb will go, right? And there's a capacitor, I think it is, that was designed to make sure that the electrical charge going to those shaped chemical charges, those shaped chemical explosive charges, would arrive all at exactly the same time with the same intensity, the same voltage, so that you would get that effect, okay? And there was an enormous crisis in the labs because the capacitors were failing and they didn't work anymore. They had been, you know, they were exposed to this, you know, they're so close to the bomb, they're getting exposed to radiation, and they were worn out. And nobody knew how to build one of these. The guys who had designed them, you know, were passed away. They couldn't find the blueprints in the lab. And Congress ended up spending something like $100 million just to reinvent this particular electronic component. I wrote an article about it at the time because it's so fundamental, you know, to mm-hmm. making a nuclear weapon work, that it's sort of like a carpenter, you know, not knowing how to make get nails anymore, that a carpenter doesn't have nails and he has to reinvent the nail. And this electronic component was that critical to making, you know, nuclear weapons, and we didn't know how to do it. And so but the labs did, they think they figured out how to do it. And, and this was accomplished, by the way, I have to drop a plug, by my
Feel
friend
free.
Lisa Gordon Haggerty, who was the director of the Nuclear National Security Agency, which is responsible for maintaining our nuclear deterrent. And I think we talked about her on your show before. She mm-hmm. actually championed during the Trump administration, saying, you know, we need to start making new nuclear weapons. And Lisa actually got a new nuclear weapon, you know, in the pipeline, or at least she had, until, unfortunately, President Trump let her get fired, you know, and Imhoff, who was the Senator Imhoff, to his credit, the Republican chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, spoke up and defended Lisa and said, what are you doing, Mr. President? Why are you letting your own person be fired by this idiot over the Secretary of Energy? He was an mm-hmm. appointee, too, from Trump, but he had been captured by the Democrat staff over there that wanted mm-hmm. to stop Lisa, you know, from modernizing our nuclear deterrent. And they succeeded.
I love that we're on the show.
You know, that's
you
the
know,
Babylon,
yeah,
great... Babylon, Washington, you know. Yeah. And anyway, it happened in the last year of the Trump administration. It was terrible. You know, just an example of how the best people in the Trump administration, you know, the president failed to protect some of the some of his own best people, you know, and let these holdovers, attack and undermine his best people. But that's
I'd love to have her on the show. I think it'd be fascinating if she's available to do that. But I've got another question for you. Speaking of new nuclear weapons, and Pianki knows this too from aviation. There was a revolution in aviation. I mean, when I learned how to fly, we had vacuum instruments. They'd spin they'd spin gyros. They'd suck air in and blow it across these gyros to make them work. And we had all kinds of other instruments that were vacuum or electric powered. And then they had this revolution, which they called the glass cockpit. In other words, it's all computerized. Your instruments are computerized. They're much more reliable. They're easy to see. You have more displays. You have two instruments instead of six. And the same thing with aircraft cables. They used to be cables and winches. You know, your 707 actually had cables running from the yoke, the stick, all the way back to the elevators and the ailerons and stuff like that. And then it went to fly-by-wire. It's all done by computers and servos and whatever the things are that make it work. Wouldn't something like that apply to nuclear weapons? It seems to me we're using, carburetors when the rest of the world is using fuel injection. We're using winches and pulleys when the rest of the world is using fly-by-wire. And we're using detection and testing equipment, that's probably vacuum tubes when we should be using, the equivalent of the glass cockpit in a modern airliner. What do you think?
Yes, that in addition to our weapons aging out, and whereas Russia and China and North Korea have got mm-hmm. all new, not only delivery systems, but their weapon systems are also new. Mm-hmm. But they've stolen an enormous technological march on them because they have what are called third-generation nuclear weapons. You know, the first-generation nuclear weapons were the kind of weapons that destroyed Hiroshima and Nagasaki. They're based on fission.
Mm-hmm.
And the second-generation nuclear weapons is the hydrogen bomb, much more powerful than these fission weapons. But both fission and fusion weapons both basically were designed for blast and shock, mm-hmm. and a mass destruction. But third-generation nuclear weapons are not chiefly designed for blast and shock. They are at least not mass destruction, type scenarios. They are designed for specialized effects like electromagnetic pulse. The Russians call them super EMP weapons. They can generate electromagnetic fields of such extraordinary strength that you could black out all of North America with one weapon, and it would paralyze our retaliatory capabilities because the EMP fields are so powerful that they exceed the hardening that we have on our command and control and on the weapons themselves. X-rays, weapons specialized for X-rays, because X-rays are also great at destroying adversary electronics, and so and don't create EMP. So it suppresses the gamma rays that cause the EMP, but puts out great X-rays. So that way, your ballistic missile interceptors, can use these X-ray warheads to intercept our warheads when they're coming in to try to attack targets in Russia without generating any EMP over their territory, because they're specialized for X-ray effects and they suppress the gamma radiation or neutron radiation, including mini-neutron weapons. So, for example, You know, and neutrons also are great for anti-electronics, but they're also good for killing personnel, you know, so that they limit collateral damage to an area you're trying to take over, like Germany. And you and the Russians are making these things so small that you could actually have a mini neutron weapon fired mm-hmm. out of a tank, you know, so that one tank could take out a whole armored brigade that it might be up against, or an armored company that it might be up against, and cause very little collateral damage, so that this would not interfere with the progress of your invading infantry and armored forces, or in air-to-air combat. Also, ultra-low-yield weapons. We've been talking about 5 kilotons
mm-hmm.
for the W-80, you know, but the Russians have got, in these third-generation weapons, ultra-low-yield, so you can go down below 1 kiloton and adjust the yield to whatever the target is, so that if you want to take out a bridge or something like the Pentagon, you could actually adjust the yield and take out the Pentagon and not break the windows of neighboring buildings that are nearby, because
wow.
the shockwave will just be that surgical for just taking out that one building, or just take out the White House and not cause collateral damage. You know, because you want to limit, a lot of people don't understand this, you know, but and when the adversary is launching a first strike, a disarming first strike, he doesn't want to mm-hmm. cause a lot of civilian casualties. That's not the goal. You want the people to survive so they can be held hostage. After you've disarmed your adversary to the extent that you can say, if you don't surrender, now I'm going to start taking out your cities one by one, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that is and that is how you fight and win a nuclear war, by disarming your adversary's capabilities, his nuclear forces and his command control system, so that he can't retaliate, and then holding the population hostage. So you'd like to cause as little damage as possible to the population you intend to hold hostage, and also the value of that society. If you can get them to surrender and take it over, you know, you want them to be able to be productive, so that they can pay you tribute or whatever, you know, in the aftermath.
Yeah, that's a classic
warfare,
that whole siege mentality. Yeah. So these weapons are fairly, these tactical ones are very, not only are they low yield, but they're also low radiation. The effects of the weapons go away. There's not like huge fallout and all kinds of other things, right?
Pure fusion weapons is another example of these third generation weapons, and they produce no fallout whatever. You know,
okay.
You only get radioactive fallout from fission weapons. The hydrogen bombs, the triggers in hydrogen bombs, you know,
mm-hmm.
the smaller you can make that trigger, the less and less fallout it will produce, you know. So and if you can eliminate the trigger altogether, if you can come up with a way to make a pure
mm-hmm.
fusion weapon, then there'll be no fallout at all. And we believe the Russians have done that they do have pure fusion warheads in these third-generation weapons.
Wow. We only have about 3 minutes left, and I wanted to you just explained perfectly how a nuclear war can be won through blackmail, extortion, through taking out the ability to resist, you know, further nuclear attacks. And it seems to me what we have here is exactly the opposite, that there's a belief in the State Department and the anti-nuke folks and the really naive, stupid people out there that think that if we get rid of all our nuclear weapons, I mean, all of them, I think this is their ultimate goal, is complete disarmament, that they can say, look, we're no threat to anybody. See, we can't attack anybody, and there's no reason to attack us because we don't have any nuclear weapons. And this kind of naive, dangerous belief is, I think, what seems to be permeating it. But that's what I think they think, that if we just get rid of all our nuclear weapons, that nobody would ever attack us because we're peace. You know, we'll peacefully coexist, as they say, not knowing that these other nations are going to go, great, okay, you're completely disarmed. We own you. But that's what I think they think. What do you think?
Oh, I think I agree with you. I think that there are in their faith-based approach to U.S. national security,
mm-hmm.
it's a religion that has two tenets. One, that nuclear weapons are evil, and that they are more evil than the evil nations like Russia, China, and North Korea. And therefore, it's a positive good for the United States to give up these evil instruments, you know, because they're even worse than Russia, China, and North Korea. And second,
mm-hmm.
that the United States is not superior to Russia, China, North Korea ethically, okay? That fundamentally, our foreign policy, they they subscribe to the vision of the new left. The new left, you know, going back to things like William Appleman Williams, the tragedy of American diplomacy, that thinks that our capitalist system, you know, has is responsible for world imperialism, and that we have caused most of the problems in the world, and so that we do not have the moral high ground when it comes to other nations, and so it's a and that we tend to be warlike, that the America tends to be the aggressive warlike country, and therefore it's a good thing to take away those nuclear capabilities from our civilization, because we're the ones more likely to use them. After all, we did use nuclear weapons during World War II, and they will often point to that as an example about about our moral inferiority compared to the other countries. That's why they never seem to worry about the nuclear programs of Russia and China and North Korea. These are articles of faith that the anti-nuclear crowd believes in, and ultimately, if they prevail, and they're prevailing right now, they're going to get all of us killed.
Yeah. On that note, I have to hold you up. This has been fascinating, but we just ran out of time, so you timed it perfectly. Thank you, sir. Let's have more bad news next week, because, again, as I say, we need to hear it.
Okay.
So thank you so much, and we'll do it again next Monday.
Well, I'll look for some good news, and maybe there'll be some, but I doubt it. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. All right. Goodbye now. And that's Dr. Peter Pry, and this is Action Radio with Greg Penglis at blogtalkradio.com/citizenaction. And you can contribute to our bill writing site if you want to see, comment on, or in any way help advance our legislative cause at www.writeyourlaws.com. That's WRITEYOURLAWS. I'll be back tomorrow morning at 7 o'clock Eastern, 6 Central, 5 Mountain, 4 Pacific, and the rest of the world. You guys could just, you know, figure it out.